Volume 1, Chapter 1. Home is the resort of love, of joy, of peace and plenty, where, supporting and supported, polished friends and dear relations mingle into bliss. Thomson. On the pleasant banks of the Garonne, in the province of Gascony, stood, in the year 1584, the Chateau of Monsieur Saint-Aubert. From its windows were seen the pastoral landscapes of Guienne and Gascony stretching along the river, gay with luxuriant woods and vine, and plantations of olives. To the south, the view was bounded by the majestic Pyrenees, whose summits, veiled in clouds, were exhibiting awful forms, seen, and lost again, as the partial vapors rolled along, were sometimes barren, and gleamed through the blue tinge of air, and sometimes frowned with forests of gloomy pine, that swept downward to their base. These tremendous precipices were contrasted by the soft green of the pastures and woods that hung upon their skirts, among whose flocks, and herds, and simple cottages, the eye, after having scaled the cliffs above, delighted to repose. To the north, and to the east, the plains of Guienne and Languedoc were lost in the mist of distance, on the west, Gascony was bounded by the waters of Biscay. M. Saint-Aubert loved to wander, with his wife and daughter, on the margin of the Garonne, and to listen to the music that floated on its waves. He had known life in other forms than those of pastoral simplicity, having mingled in the gay and in the busy scenes of the world, but the flattering portrait of mankind, which his heart had delineated in early youth, his experience had too sorrowfully corrected. Yet, amidst the changing visions of life, his principles remained unshaken, his benevolence unchilled, and he retired from the multitude more in underscore pity underscore than in anger, to scenes of simple nature, to the pure delights of literature, and to the exercise of domestic virtues. He was a descendant from the younger branch of an illustrious family, and it was designed that the deficiency of his patrimonial wealth should be supplied either by a splendid alliance in marriage, or by success in the intrigues of public affairs. But Saint-Aubert had too nice a sense of honor to fulfill the latter hope, and too small a portion of ambition to sacrifice what he called happiness, to the attainment of wealth. After the death of his father he married a very amiable woman, his equal in birth, and not his superior in fortune. The late Monsieur Saint-Aubert's liberality, or extravagance, had so much involved his affairs, that his son found it necessary to dispose of a part of the family domain, and, some years after his marriage, he sold it to Monsieur Quesnel, the brother of his wife, and retired to a small estate in Gascony, where conjugal felicity, and parental duties, divided his attention with the treasures of knowledge and the illuminations of genius. To this spot he had been attached from his infancy. He had often made excursions to it when a boy, and the impressions of delight given to his mind by the homely kindness of the grey-headed peasant, to whom it was entrusted, and whose fruit and cream never failed, had not been obliterated by succeeding circumstances. The green pastures along which he had so often bounded in the exaltation of health, and youthful freedom, the woods, under whose refreshing shade he had first indulged that pensive melancholy, which afterwards made a strong feature of his character, the wild walks of the mountains, the river, on whose waves he had floated, and the distant plains, which seemed boundless as his early hopes, were never after remembered by Saint-Aubert but with enthusiasm and regret. At length he disengaged himself from the world, and retired hither, to realize the wishes of many years. The building, as it then stood, was merely a summer cottage, rendered interesting to a stranger by its neat simplicity, or the beauty of the surrounding scene, and considerable additions were necessary to make it a comfortable family residence. Saint-Aubert felt a kind of affection for every part of the fabric, which he remembered in his youth, and would not suffer a stone of it to be removed, so that the new building, adapted to the style of the old one, formed with it only a simple and elegant residence. The taste of Madame Saint-Aubert was conspicuous in its internal finishing, where the same chaste simplicity was observable in the furniture, and in the few ornaments of the apartments, that characterized the manners of its inhabitants. The library occupied the west side of the chateau, and was enriched by a collection of the best books in the ancient and modern languages. This room opened upon a grove, which stood on the brow of a gentle declivity, that fell towards the river, and the tall trees gave it a melancholy and pleasing shade, while from the windows the eye caught, beneath the spreading branches, the gay and luxuriant landscape stretching to the west, and overlooked on the left by the bold precipices of the Pyrenees. Adjoining the library was a greenhouse, stored with scarce and beautiful plants, for one of the amusements of Saint-Aubert was the study of botany, and among the neighboring mountains, which afforded a luxurious feast to the mind of the naturalist, he often passed the day in the pursuit of his favorite science. He was sometimes accompanied in these little excursions by Madame Saint-Aubert, and frequently by his daughter, when, with a small osier basket to receive plants, and another filled with cold refreshments, such as the cabin of the shepherd did not afford, They wandered away among the most romantic and magnificent scenes, nor suffered the charms of nature's lowly children to abstract them from the observance of her stupendous works. When weary of sauntering among cliffs that seemed scarcely accessible but to the steps of the enthusiast, and where no track appeared on the vegetation, but what the foot of the izzard had left, they would seek one of those green recesses, which so beautifully adorn the bosom of these mountains, where, under the shade of the lofty larch, or cedar, they enjoyed their simple repast, made sweeter by the waters of the cool stream, that crept along the turf, and by the breath of wild flowers and aromatic plants, that fringed the rocks, and inlaid the grass. Adjoining the eastern side of the greenhouse, looking towards the plains of Languedoc, was a room, which Emily called hers, and which contained her books, her drawings, her musical instruments, with some favorite birds and plants. Here she usually exercised herself in elegant arts, cultivated only because they were congenial to her taste, and in which native genius, assisted by the instructions of Monsieur and Madame Saint-Aubert, made her an early proficient. The windows of this room were particularly pleasant. They descended to the floor, and, opening upon the little lawn that surrounded the house, the eye was led between groves of almond, palm trees, flowering ash, and myrtle, to the distant landscape, where the Garonne wandered. The peasants of this gay climate were often seen on an evening, when the day's labor was done, dancing in groups on the margin of the river. Their sprightly melodies, underscore debonair underscore steps, the fanciful figure of their dances, with the tasteful and capricious manner in which the girls adjusted their simple dress, gave a character to the scene entirely French. The front of the château, which, having a southern aspect, opened upon the grandeur of the mountains, was occupied on the ground floor by a rustic hall, and two excellent sitting rooms. The first floor, for the cottage had no second story, was laid out in bedchambers, except one apartment that opened to a balcony, and which was generally used for a breakfast room. In the surrounding ground, Saint-Aubert had made very tasteful improvements, yet, such was his attachment to objects he had remembered from his boyish days, that he had in some instances sacrificed taste to sentiment. There were two old larches that shaded the building, and interrupted the prospect. Saint-Aubert had sometimes declared that he believed he should have been weak enough to have wept at their fall. In addition to these larches he planted a little grove of beech, pine, and mountain ash. On a lofty terrace, formed by the swelling bank of the river, rose a plantation of orange, lemon, and palm trees, whose fruit, in the coolness of evening, breathed delicious fragrance. With these were mingled a few trees of other species. Here, under the ample shade of a plane tree, that spread its majestic canopy towards the river, Saint-Aubert loved to sit in the fine evenings of summer, with his wife and children, watching, beneath its foliage, the setting sun, the mild splendor of its light fading from the distant landscape, till the shadows of twilight melted its various features into one tint of sober gray. Here, too, he loved to read, and to converse with Madame Saint-Aubert, or to play with his children, resigning himself to the influence of those sweet affections, which are ever attendant on simplicity and nature. He has often said, while tears of pleasure trembled in his eyes, that these were moments infinitely more delightful than any passed amid the brilliant and tumultuous scenes that are courted by the world. His heart was occupied, it had, what can be so rarely said, no wish for a happiness beyond what it experienced. The consciousness of acting right diffused a serenity over his manners, which nothing else could impart to a man of moral perceptions like his, and which refined his sense of every surrounding blessing. The deepest shade of twilight did not send him from his favorite plane tree. He loved the soothing hour, when the last tints of light die away, when the stars, one by one, tremble through ether, and are reflected on the dark mirror of the waters, that hour, which, of all others, inspires the mind with pensive tenderness, and often elevates it to sublime contemplation. When the moon shed her soft rays among the foliage, he still lingered, and his pastoral supper of cream and fruits was often spread beneath it. Then, on the stillness of night, came the song of the nightingale, breathing sweetness, and awakening melancholy. The first interruptions to the happiness he had known since his retirement, were occasioned by the death of his two sons. He lost them at that age when infantine simplicity is so fascinating, and though, in consideration of Madame Saint-Aubert's distress, he restrained the expression of his own, and endeavored to bear it, as he meant, with philosophy, he had, in truth, no philosophy that could render him calm to such losses. One daughter was now his only surviving child, and, while he watched the unfolding of her infant character, with anxious fondness, he endeavored, with unremitting effort, to counteract those traits in her disposition, which might hereafter lead her from happiness. She had discovered in her early years uncommon delicacy of mind, warm affections, and ready benevolence, but with ease was observable a degree of susceptibility too exquisite to admit of lasting peace. As she advanced in youth, this sensibility gave a pensive tone to her spirits, and a softness to her manner, which added grace to beauty, and rendered her a very interesting object to persons of a congenial disposition. But St. Aubert had too much good sense to prefer a charm to a virtue, and had penetration enough to see that this charm was too dangerous to its possessor to be allowed the character of a blessing. He endeavored, therefore, to strengthen her mind, to inure her to habits of self-command, to teach her to reject the first impulse of her feelings, and to look, with cool examination, upon the disappointments he sometimes threw in her way. While he instructed her to resist first impressions, and to acquire that steady dignity of mind, that can alone counterbalance the passions, and bear us, as far as is compatible with our nature, above the reach of circumstances, he taught himself a lesson of fortitude, for he was often obliged to witness, with seeming indifference, the tears and struggles which his caution occasioned her. In person, Emily resembled her mother, having the same elegant symmetry of form, the same delicacy of features, and the same blue eyes, full of tender sweetness. But, lovely as was her person, it was the varied expression of her countenance, as conversation awakened the nicer emotions of her mind, that threw such a captivating grace around her. Those tender tints, that shun the careless eye, and, in the world's contagious circle, die. St. Aubert cultivated her understanding with the most scrupulous care. He gave her a general view of the sciences, and an exact acquaintance with every part of elegant literature. He taught her Latin and English, chiefly that she might understand the sublimity of their best poets. She discovered in her early years a taste for works of genius, and it was St. Aubert's principle, as well as his inclination, to promote every innocent means of happiness. A well-informed mind, he would say, is the best security against the contagion of folly and of vice. The vacant mind is ever on the watch for relief, and ready to plunge into error, to escape from the languor of idleness. Store it with ideas, teach it the pleasure of thinking, and the temptations of the world without, will be counteracted by the gratifications derived from the world within. Thought, and cultivation, are necessary equally to the happiness of a country and a city life. In the first they prevent the uneasy sensations of indolence, and afford a sublime pleasure in the taste they create for the beautiful, and the grand. In the latter, they make dissipation less an object of necessity, and consequently of interest. It was one of Emily's earliest pleasures to ramble among the scenes of nature, nor was it in the soft and glowing landscape that she most delighted. She loved more the wild wood walks, that skirted the mountain, and still more the mountain's stupendous recesses, where the silence and grandeur of solitude impressed a sacred awe upon her heart, and lifted her thoughts to the God of heaven and earth. In scenes like these she would often linger along, wrapped in a melancholy charm, till the last gleam of day faded from the west, till the lonely sound of a sheep bell, or the distant bark of a watchdog, were all that broke on the stillness of the evening. Then, the gloom of the woods, the trembling of their leaves, at intervals, in the breeze, the bat, flitting on the twilight, the cottage lights, now seen, and now lost, were circumstances that awakened her mind into effort, and led to enthusiasm and poetry. Her favorite walk was to a little fishing house, belonging to St. Aubert, in a woody glen, on the margin of a rivulet that descended from the Pyrenees, and, after foaming among their rocks, wound its silent way beneath the shades it reflected. Above the woods, that screened this glen, rose the lofty summits of the Pyrenees, which often burst boldly on the eye through the glades below. Sometimes the shattered face of a rock only was seen, crowned with wild shrubs, or a shepherd's cabin seated on a cliff, overshadowed by dark cypress, or waving ash. Emerging from the deep recesses of the woods, the glade opened to the distant landscape, where the rich pastures and vine-covered slopes of Gascony gradually declined to the plains, and there, on the winding shores of the Garonne, groves, and hamlets, and villas, their outlines softened by distance, melted from the eye into one rich harmonious tint. This, too, was the favorite retreat of St. Aubert, to which he frequently withdrew from the fervor of noon, with his wife, his daughter, and his books, or came at the sweet evening hour to welcome the silent dusk, or to listen for the music of the nightingale. Sometimes, too, he brought music of his own, and awakened every fairy echo with the tender accents of his oboe, and often have the tones of Emily's voice drawn sweetness from the waves, over which they trembled. It was in one of these excursions to this spot, that she observed the following lines written with a pencil on a part of the wainscot. Sonnet. Go, pencil. Faithful to thy master's sighs. Go, tell the goddess of the fairy scene, when next her light steps wind these wood walks green, whence all his tears, his tender sorrows, rise, ah. Paint her form, her soul illumined eyes, The sweet expression of her pensive face, the lightning smile, the animated grace, the portrait well the lover's voice supplies, speaks all his heart must feel, his tongue would say, yet ah! Not all his heart must sadly feel. How oft the floweret's silken leaves conceal the drug that steals the vital spark away. And who that gazes on that angel smile, would fear its charm, or think it could beguile. These lines were not inscribed to any person, Emily therefore could not apply them to herself, though she was undoubtedly the nymph of these shades. Having glanced round the little circle of her acquaintance without being detained by a suspicion as to whom they could be addressed, she was compelled to rest in uncertainty, an uncertainty which would have been more painful to an idle mind than it was to hers. She had no leisure to suffer this circumstance, trifling at first, to swell into importance by frequent remembrance. The little vanity it had excited, for the incertitude which forbade her to presume upon having inspired the sonnet, forbade her also to disbelieve it, passed away, and the incident was dismissed from her thoughts amid her books, her studies, and the exercise of social charities. Soon after this period, her anxiety was awakened by the indisposition of her father, who was attacked with a fever, which, though not thought to be of a dangerous kind, gave a severe shock to his constitution. Madame St. Aubert and Emily attended him with unremitting care, but his recovery was very slow, and, as he advanced towards health, Madame seemed to decline. The first scene he visited, after he was well enough to take the air, was his favorite fishing house. A basket of provisions was sent thither, with books, and Emily's lute, for fishing tackle he had no use, for he never could find amusement in torturing or destroying. After employing himself, for about an hour, in botanizing, dinner was served. It was a repast, to which gratitude, for being again permitted to visit this spot, gave sweetness, and family happiness once more smiled beneath these shades. Monsieur St. Aubert conversed with unusual cheerfulness, every object delighted his senses. The refreshing pleasure from the first view of nature, after the pain of illness, and the confinement of a sick chamber, is above the conceptions, as well as the descriptions, of those in health. The green woods and pastures, the flowery turf, the blue concave of the heavens, the balmy air, the murmur of the limpid stream, and even the hum of every little insect of the shade, seem to revivify the soul, and make mere existence bliss. Madame St. Aubert, reanimated by the cheerfulness and recovery of her husband, was no longer sensible of the indisposition which had lately oppressed her, and, as she sauntered along the wood walks of this romantic glen, and conversed with him, and with her daughter, she often looked at them alternately with a degree of tenderness, that filled her eyes with tears. St. Aubert observed this more than once, and gently reproved her for the emotion, but she could only smile, clasp his hand, and that of Emily, and weep the more. He felt the tender enthusiasm stealing upon himself in a degree that became almost painful, his features assumed a serious air, and he could not forbear secretly sighing, "Perhaps I shall some time look back to these moments, as to the summit of my happiness, with hopeless regret. But let me not misuse them by useless anticipation, let me hope I shall not live to mourn the loss of those who are dearer to me than life." To relieve, or perhaps to indulge, the pensive temper of his mind, he bade Emily fetch the lute she knew how to touch with such sweet pathos. As she drew nearer the fishing house, she was surprised to hear the tones of the instrument, which were awakened by the hand of taste, and uttered a plaintive air, whose exquisite melody engaged all her attention. She listened in profound silence, afraid to move from the spot, lest the sound of her steps should occasion her to lose a note of the music, or should disturb the musician. Everything without the building was still, and no person appeared. She continued to listen, till timidity succeeded to surprise and delight, a timidity, increased by a remembrance of the penciled lines she had formerly seen, and she hesitated whether to proceed, or to return. While she paused, the music ceased, and, after a momentary hesitation, she recollected courage to advance to the fishing house, which she entered with faltering steps, and found unoccupied. Her lute lay on the table, everything seemed undisturbed, and she began to believe it was another instrument she had heard, till she remembered, that, when she followed M. and Madame St. Aubert from this spot, her lute was left on a window seat. She felt alarmed, yet knew not wherefore. The melancholy gloom of evening, and the profound stillness of the place, interrupted only by the light trembling of leaves, heightened her fanciful apprehensions, and she was desirous of quitting the building, but perceived herself grow faint, and sat down. As she tried to recover herself, the penciled lines on the wainscot met her eye. She started, as if she had seen a stranger, but, endeavoring to conquer the tremor of her spirits, rose, and went to the window. To the lines before noticed she now perceived that others were added, in which her name appeared. Though no longer suffered to doubt that they were addressed to herself, She was as ignorant, as before, by whom they could be written. While she mused, she thought she heard the sound of a step without the building, and again alarmed, she caught up her lute, and hurried away. Monsieur and Madame Saint-Aubert she found in a little path that wound along the sides of the glen. Having reached a green summit, shadowed by palm trees, and overlooking the valleys and plains of Gascony, they seated themselves on the turf, and while their eyes wandered over the glorious scene, and they inhaled the sweet breath of flowers and herbs that enriched the grass, Emily played and sung several of their favorite airs, with the delicacy of expression in which she so much excelled. Music and conversation detained them in this enchanting spot, till the sun's last light slept upon the plains, till the white sails that glided beneath the mountains, where the Garonne wandered, became dim, and the gloom of evening stole over the landscape. It was a melancholy but not unpleasing gloom. Saint-Aubert and his family rose, and left the place with regret, alas. Madame Saint-Aubert knew not that she left it forever. When they reached the fishing house she missed her bracelet, and recollected that she had taken it from her arm after dinner, and had left it on the table when she went to walk. After a long search, in which Emily was very active, she was compelled to resign herself to the loss of it. What made this bracelet valuable to her was a miniature of her daughter to which it was attached, esteemed a striking resemblance, and which had been painted only a few months before. When Emily was convinced that the bracelet was really gone, she blushed, and became thoughtful. That some stranger had been in the fishing house, during her absence, her lute, and the additional lines of a pencil, had already informed her. From the purport of these lines it was not unreasonable to believe, that the poet, the musician, and the thief were the same person. But though the music she had heard, the written lines she had seen, and the disappearance of the picture, formed a combination of circumstances very remarkable, she was irresistibly restrained from mentioning them, secretly determining, however, never again to visit the fishing house without Monsieur or Madame Saint-Aubert. They returned pensively to the chateau, Emily musing on the incident which had just occurred, Saint-Aubert reflecting, with placid gratitude, on the blessings he possessed, and Madame Saint-Aubert somewhat disturbed, and perplexed, by the loss of her daughter's picture. As they drew near the house, they observed an unusual bustle about it, the sound of voices was distinctly heard, servants and horses were seen passing between the trees, and, at length, the wheels of a carriage rolled along. Having come within view of the front of the chateau, a landau, with smoking horses, appeared on the little lawn before it. Saint-Aubert perceived the liveries of his brother-in-law, and in the parlor he found Monsieur and Madame Quesnel already entered. They had left Paris some days before, and were on the way to their estate, only 10 leagues distant from La Vallée, and which Monsieur Quesnel had purchased several years before of Saint-Aubert. This gentleman was the only brother of Madame Saint-Aubert, but the ties of relationship having never been strengthened by congeniality of character, the intercourse between them had not been frequent. M. Quesnel had lived altogether in the world, his aim had been consequence, splendor was the object of his taste, and his address and knowledge of character had carried him forward to the attainment of almost all that he had courted. By a man of such a disposition, it is not surprising that the virtues of Saint-Aubert should be overlooked, or that his pure taste, simplicity, and moderated wishes, were considered as marks of a weak intellect, and of confined views. The marriage of his sister with Saint-Aubert had been mortifying to his ambition, for he had designed that the matrimonial connection she formed should assist him to attain the consequence which he so much desired, and some offers were made her by persons whose rank and fortune flattered his warmest hope. But his sister, who was then addressed also by Saint-Aubert, perceived, or thought she perceived, that happiness and splendor were not the same, and she did not hesitate to forego the last for the attainment of the former. Whether Monsieur Quesnel thought them the same, or not, he would readily have sacrificed his sister's peace to the gratification of his own ambition, and, on her marriage with Saint-Aubert, expressed in private his contempt of her spiritless conduct, and of the connection which it permitted. Madame Saint-Aubert, though she concealed this insult from her husband, felt, perhaps, for the first time, resentment lighted in her heart, and, though a regard for her own dignity, united with considerations of prudence, restrained her expression of this resentment, there was ever after a mild reserve in her manner towards M. Quesnel, which he both understood and felt. In his own marriage he did not follow his sister's example. His lady was an Italian, and an heiress by birth, and, by nature and education, was a vain and frivolous woman. They now determined to pass the night with Saint-Aubert, and as the chateau was not large enough to accommodate their servants, the latter were dismissed to the neighboring village. When the first compliments were over, and the arrangements for the night made, M. Quesnel began the display of his intelligence and his connections, while Saint-Aubert, who had been long enough in retirement to find these topics recommended by their novelty, listened, with a degree of patience and attention, which his guest mistook for the humility of wonder. The latter, indeed, described the few festivities which the turbulence of that period permitted to the court of Henry III, with a minuteness that somewhat recompensed for his ostentation, but, when he came to speak of the character of the Duc de Joyeuse, of a secret treaty, which he knew to be negotiating with the Porte, and of the light in which Henry of Navarre was received, M. Saint Aubert recollected enough of his former experience to be assured that his guest could be only of an inferior class of politicians, and that, from the importance of the subjects upon which he committed himself, he could not be of the rank to which he pretended to belong. The opinions delivered by M. Quesnel were such as Saint Aubert forbore to reply to, for he knew that his guest had neither humanity to feel, nor discernment to perceive, what is just. Madame Quesnel, meanwhile, was expressing to Madame Saint Aubert her astonishment that she could bear to pass her life in this remote corner of the world, as she called it, and describing, from a wish, probably, of exciting envy, the splendor of the balls, banquets, and processions which had just been given by the court, in honor of the nuptials of the Duc de Joyeuse with Margaretha of Lorraine, the sister of the Queen. She described with equal minuteness the magnificence she had seen, and that from which she had been excluded, while Emily's vivid fancy, as she listened with the ardent curiosity of youth, heightened the scenes she heard of, and Madame Saint Aubert, looking on her family, felt, as a tear stole to her eye, that though splendor may grace happiness, virtue only can bestow it. "It is now 12 years, Saint Aubert," said M. Quesnel, "since I purchased your family estate." "Somewhere thereabout," replied Saint Aubert, suppressing a sigh. "It is near 5 years since I have been there," resumed Quesnel, "for Paris and its neighborhood is the only place in the world to live in, and I am so immersed in politics, and have so many affairs of moment on my hands, that I find it difficult to steal away even for a month or two." Saint Aubert remaining silent, M. Quesnel proceeded, "I have sometimes wondered how you, who have lived in the capital, and have been accustomed to company, can exist elsewhere, especially in so remote a country as this, where you can neither hear nor see anything, and can in short be scarcely conscious of life." "I live for my family and myself," said Saint Aubert. "I am now contented to know only happiness. Formerly I knew life." "I mean to expend 30 or 40 thousand livres on improvements," said M. Quesnel, without seeming to notice the words of Saint Aubert, "for I design, next summer, to bring here my friends, the Duc de Durafort and the Marquis Ramont, to pass a month or two with me." To Saint Aubert's inquiry as to these intended improvements, he replied that he should take down the whole east wing of the chateau, and raise upon the side a set of stables. "Then I shall build," said he, a salle à manger, a salon, and a number of rooms for servants, for at present there is not accommodation for a third part of my own people." "It accommodated our father's household," said Saint Aubert, grieved that the old mansion was to be thus improved, and that was not a small one. "Our notions are somewhat enlarged since those days," said M. Quesnel. "What was then thought a decent style of living would not now be endured." Even the calm Saint Aubert blushed at these words, but his anger soon yielded to contempt. "The ground about the chateau is encumbered with trees. I mean to cut some of them down."
"Cut down the trees too," said Saint Aubert.
"Certainly. Why should I not? They interrupt my prospects. There is a chestnut which spreads its branches before the whole south side of the chateau, and which is so ancient that they tell me the hollow of its trunk will hold a dozen men. Your enthusiasm will scarcely contend that there can be either use, or beauty, in such a sapless old tree as this."
"Good God!" exclaimed Saint Aubert, "you surely will not destroy that noble chestnut, which has flourished for centuries, the glory of the estate. It was in its maturity when the present mansion was built. How often, in my youth, have I climbed among its broad branches, and sat embowered amidst a world of leaves, while the heavy shower has pattered above, and not a raindrop reached me. How often I have sat with a book in my hand, sometimes reading, and sometimes looking out between the branches upon the wide landscape, and the setting sun, till twilight came, and brought the birds home to their little nests among the leaves. How often, but pardon me," added Saint Aubert, recollecting that he was speaking to a man who could neither comprehend, nor allow his feelings, "I am talking of times and feelings as old-fashioned as the taste that would spare that venerable tree."
"It will certainly come down," said M. Quesnel. "I believe I shall plant some Lombardy poplars among the clumps of chestnut that I shall leave of the avenue. Madame Quesnel is partial to the poplar, and tells me how much it adorns a villa of her uncle, not far from Venice. On the banks of the Brenta, indeed," continued Saint Aubert, "where its spiry form is intermingled with the pine,
and the cypress, and where it plays over light and elegant porticos and colonnades, it, unquestionably, adorns the scene, but among the giants of the forest, and near a heavy Gothic mansion. "Well, my good sir," said M.K.N.L., "I will not dispute with you. You must return to Paris before our ideas can at all agree. But underscore apropos underscore of Venice, I have some thoughts of going thither, next summer. Events may call me to take possession of that same villa, too, which they tell me is the most charming that can be imagined. In that case I shall leave the improvements I mentioned to another year, and I may, perhaps, be tempted to stay some time in Italy." Emily was somewhat surprised to hear him talk of being tempted to remain abroad, after he had mentioned his presence to be so necessary at Paris, that it was with difficulty he could steal away for a month or two, but Saint Aubert understood the self-importance of the man too well to wonder at this trait, and the possibility, that these projected improvements might be deferred, gave them a hope, that they might never take place. Before they separated for the night, M.K.N.L. desired to speak with Saint Aubert alone, and they retired to another room, where they remained a considerable time. The subject of this conversation was not known, but, whatever it might be, Saint Aubert, when he returned to the supper room, seemed much disturbed, and a shade of sorrow sometimes fell upon his features that alarmed Madame Saint Aubert. When they were alone she was tempted to inquire the occasion of it, but the delicacy of mind, which had ever appeared in his conduct, restrained her. She considered that, if Saint Aubert wished her to be acquainted with the subject of his concern, he would not wait on her inquiries. On the following day, before M.K.N.L. departed, he had a second conference with Saint Aubert. The guests, after dining at the chateau, set out in the cool of the day for Porville, whither they gave him and Madame Saint Aubert a pressing invitation, prompted rather by the vanity of displaying their splendor, than by a wish to make their friends happy. Emily returned, with delight, to the liberty which their presence had restrained, to her books, her walks, and the rational conversation of M. and Madame Saint Aubert, who seemed to rejoice, no less, that they were delivered from the shackles, which arrogance and frivolity had imposed. Madame Saint Aubert excused herself from sharing their usual evening walk, complaining that she was not quite well, and Saint Aubert and Emily went out together. They chose a walk towards the mountains, intending to visit some old pensioners of Saint Aubert, which, from his very moderate income, he contrived to support, though it is probable M.K.N.L., with his very large one, could not have afforded this. After distributing to his pensioners their weekly stipends, listening patiently to the complaints of some, redressing the grievances of others, and softening the discontents of all, by the look of sympathy, and the smile of benevolence, Saint Aubert returned home through the woods. Where, at fall of eve the fairy people throng, in various games and revelry to pass the summer night, as village stories tell. Thomson. "The evening gloom of woods was always delightful to me," said Saint Aubert, whose mind now experienced the sweet calm, which results from the consciousness of having done a beneficent action, and which disposes it to receive pleasure from every surrounding object. "I remember that in my youth this gloom used to call forth to my fancy a thousand fairy visions, and romantic images, and, I own, I am not yet wholly insensible of that high enthusiasm, which wakes the poet's dream. I can linger, with solemn steps, under the deep shades, send forward a transforming eye into the distant obscurity, and listen with thrilling delight to the mystic murmuring of the woods." "Oh my dear father," said Emily, while a sudden tear started to her eye, "how exactly you describe what I have felt so often, and which I thought nobody had ever felt but myself. But hark! Here comes the sweeping sound over the wood tops, now it dies away, how solemn the stillness that succeeds! Now the breeze swells again. It is like the voice of some supernatural being, the voice of the spirit of the woods, that watches over them by night. Ah! What light is yonder? But it is gone. And now it gleams again, near the root of that large chestnut. Look, sir." "Are you such an admirer of nature," said Saint Aubert, "and so little acquainted with her appearances as not to know that for the glowworm? But come," added he gaily, "step a little further, and we shall see fairies. Perhaps, they are often companions. The glowworm lends his light, and they in return charm him with music, and the dance. Do you see nothing tripping yonder?" Emily laughed. "Well, my dear sir," said she, "since you allow of this alliance, I may venture to own I have anticipated you, and almost dare venture to repeat some verses I made one evening in these very woods." "Nay," replied Saint Aubert, "dismiss the underscore almost underscore, and venture quite, let us hear what vagaries fancy has been playing in your mind. If she has given you one of her spells, you need not envy those of the fairies." "If it is strong enough to enchant your judgment, sir," said Emily, While I disclose her images, I need underscore not underscore envy them. The lines go in a sort of tripping measure, which I thought might suit the subject well enough, but I fear they are too irregular. The glowworm. How pleasant is the greenwood's deep matted shade on a midsummer's eve, when the fresh rain is o'er, when the yellow beams slope, and sparkle through the glade, and swiftly in the thin air the light swallows soar. But sweeter, sweeter still, when the sun sinks to rest, and twilight comes on, with the fairies so gay tripping through the forest walk, where flowers, unprist, bow not their tall heads beneath their frolic play. To music's softest sounds they dance away the hour, till moonlight steals down among the trembling leaves, and checkers all the ground, and guides them to the bower, the long-haunted bower, where the nightingale grieves. Then no more they dance, till her sad song is done, but, silent as the night, to her mourning attend, and often as her dying notes their pity have won, they vow all her sacred haunts from mortals to defend. When, down among the mountains, sinks the evening star, and the changing moon forsakes this shadowy sphere, how cheerless would they be, though they fairies are, if I, with my pale light, came not near? Yet cheerless though they'd be, they're ungrateful to my love. For, often when the traveler's benighted on his way, and I glimmer in his path, and would guide him through the grove, they bind me in their magic spells to lead him far astray. And in the mire to leave him, till the stars are all burned out, while, in strange-looking shapes, they frisk about the ground, and, afar in the woods, they raise a dismal shout, till I shrink into my cell again for terror of the sound. But, see where all the tiny elves come dancing in a ring, with the merry, merry pipe, and the tabor, and the horn, and the timbrel so clear, and the lute with dulcet string, then round about the oak they go till peeping of the morn. Down yonder glade two lovers steal, to shun the fairy queen, who frowns upon their plighted vows, and jealous is of me, that yestereve I lighted them, along the dewy green, to seek the purple flower, whose juice from all her spells can free. And now, to punish me, she keeps afar her jocund band, with the merry, merry pipe, and the tabor, and the lute. If I creep near yonder oak she will wave her fairy wand, and to me the dance will cease, and the music all be mute. Oh! Had I but that purple flower whose leaves her charms can foil, and knew like phase to draw the juice, and throw it on the wind, I'd be her slave no longer, nor the traveler beguile, and help all faithful lovers, nor fear the fairy kind. But soon the underscore vapor of the woods underscore will wander afar, and the fickle moon will fade, and the stars disappear, then, cheerless will they be, though they fairies are, if I, with my pale light, come not near. Whatever St. Aubert might think of the stanzas, he would not deny his daughter the pleasure of believing that he approved them, and, having given his commendation, he sunk into a reverie, and they walked on in silence. A faint erroneous ray, glanced from th imperfect surfaces of things, flung half an image on the straining eye, while waving woods, and villages, and streams, and rocks, and mountain tops, that long retain the ascending gleam, are all one swimming scene, uncertain if beheld. Thomson. St. Aubert continued silent till he reached the chateau, where his wife had retired to her chamber. The languor and dejection, that had lately oppressed her, and which the exertion called forth by the arrival of her guests had suspended, now returned with increased effect. On the following day, symptoms of fever appeared, and St. Aubert, having sent for medical advice, learned that her disorder was a fever of the same nature as that from which he had lately recovered. She had, indeed, taken the infection during her attendance upon him, and, her constitution being too weak to throw out the disease immediately, it had lurked in her veins, and occasioned the heavy languor of which she had complained. St. Aubert, whose anxiety for his wife overcame every other consideration, detained the physician in his house. He remembered the feelings and the reflections that had called a momentary gloom upon his mind, on the day when he had last visited the fishing house, in company with Madame St. Aubert, and he now admitted a presentiment, that this illness would be a fatal one. But he effectually concealed this from her, and from his daughter, whom he endeavored to reanimate with hopes that her constant assiduities would not be unavailing. The physician, when asked by St. Aubert for his opinion of the disorder, replied, that the event of it depended upon circumstances which he could not ascertain. Madame St. Aubert seemed to have formed a more decided one, but her eyes only gave hints of this. She frequently fixed them upon her anxious friends with an expression of pity, and of tenderness, as if she anticipated the sorrow that awaited them. And that seemed to say, it was for their sakes only, for their sufferings, that she regretted life. On the seventh day, the disorder was at its crisis. The physician assumed a graver manner, which she observed, and took occasion, when her family had once quitted the chamber, to tell him, that she perceived her death was approaching. Do not attempt to deceive me, said she, I feel that I cannot long survive. I am prepared for the event, I have long, I hope, been preparing for it. Since I have not long to live, do not suffer a mistaken compassion to induce you to flatter my family with false hopes. If you do, their affliction will only be the heavier when it arrives. I will endeavor to teach them resignation by my example. The physician was affected, he promised to obey her, and told Street Aubert, somewhat abruptly, that there was nothing to expect. The latter was not philosopher enough to restrain his feelings when he received this information, but a consideration of the increased affliction which the observance of his grief would occasion his wife, enabled him, after some time, to command himself in her presence. Emily was at first overwhelmed with the intelligence, then, deluded by the strength of her wishes, a hope sprung up in her mind that her mother would yet recover, and to this she pertinaciously adhered almost to the last hour. The progress of this disorder was marked, on the side of Madame Street Aubert, by patient suffering, and subjected wishes. The composure, with which she awaited her death, could be derived only from the retrospect of a life governed, as far as human frailty permits, by a consciousness of being always in the presence of the Deity, and by the hope of a higher world. But her piety could not entirely subdue the grief of parting from those whom she so dearly loved. During these her last hours, she conversed much with Saint Aubert and Emily, on the prospect of futurity, and on other religious topics. The resignation she expressed, with the firm hope of meeting in a future world the friend she left in this, and the effort which sometimes appeared to conceal her sorrow at this temporary separation, frequently affected Saint Aubert so much as to oblige him to leave the room. Having indulged his tears a while, he would dry them and return to the chamber with a countenance composed by an endeavor which did but increase his grief. Never had Emily felt the importance of the lessons, which had taught her to restrain her sensibility, so much as in these moments, and never had she practiced them with a triumph so complete. But when the last was over, she sunk at once under the pressure of her sorrow, and then perceived that it was hope, as well as fortitude, which had hitherto supported her. Saint Aubert was for a time too devoid of comfort himself to bestow any on his daughter. Chapter 2. I could a tale unfold, whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul. Shakespeare. Madame Saint Aubert was interred in the neighboring village church. Her husband and daughter attended her to the grave, followed by a long train of the peasantry, who were sincere mourners of this excellent woman. On his return from the funeral, Saint Aubert shut himself in his chamber. When he came forth, it was with a serene countenance, though pale in sorrow. He gave orders that his family should attend him. Emily only was absent, who, overcome with the scene she had just witnessed, had retired to her closet to weep alone. Saint Aubert followed her thither, he took her hand in silence, while she continued to weep, and it was some moments before he could so far command his voice as to speak. It trembled while he said, "My Emily, I am going to prayers with my family, you will join us. We must ask support from above. Where else ought we to seek it, where else can we find it?" Emily checked her tears, and followed her father to the parlor, where, the servants being assembled, Saint Aubert read, in a low and solemn voice, the evening service, and added a prayer for the soul of the departed. During this, his voice often faltered, his tears fell upon the book, and at length he paused. But the sublime emotions of pure devotion gradually elevated his views above this world, and finally brought comfort to his heart. When the service was ended, and the servants were withdrawn, he tenderly kissed Emily, and said, "I have endeavored to teach you, from your earliest youth, the duty of self-command. I have pointed out to you the great importance of it through life, not only as it preserves us in the various and dangerous temptations that call us from rectitude and virtue, but as it limits the indulgences which are termed virtuous, yet which, extended beyond a certain boundary, are vicious, for their consequence is evil. All excess is vicious, even that sorrow, which is amiable in its origin, becomes a selfish and unjust passion, if indulged at the expense of our duties. By our duties I mean what we owe to ourselves, as well as to others. The indulgence of excessive grief enervates the mind, and almost incapacitates it for again partaking of those various innocent enjoyments which a benevolent God designed to be the sunshine of our lives. My dear Emily, recollect and practice the precepts I have so often given you, and which your own experience has so often shown you to be wise. Your sorrow is useless. Do not receive this as merely a commonplace remark, but let reason underscore therefore underscore restrain sorrow. I would not annihilate your feelings, my child, I would only teach you to command them, for whatever may be the evils resulting from a too susceptible heart, nothing can be hoped from an insensible one. That, on the other hand, is all vice, vice, of which the deformity is not softened, or the effect consoled for, by any semblance or possibility of good. You know my sufferings, and are, therefore, convinced that mine are not the light words which, on these occasions, are so often repeated to destroy even the sources of honest emotion, or which merely display the selfish ostentation of a false philosophy. I will show my Emily, that I can practice what I advise. I have said thus much, because I cannot bear to see you wasting in useless sorrow, for one of that resistance which is due from mind, and I have not said it till now, because there is a period when all reasoning must yield to nature, that is past, and another, when excessive indulgence, having sunk into habit, weighs down the elasticity of the spirits so as to render conquest nearly impossible, this is to come. You, my Emily, will show that you are willing to avoid it. Emily smiled through her tears upon her father, "Dear sir," said she, and her voice trembled, she would have added, "I will show myself worthy of being your daughter," but a mingled emotion of gratitude, affection, and grief overcame her. Saint Aubert suffered her to weep without interruption, and then began to talk on common topics. The first person who came to condole with Saint Aubert was A.M. Barrows, an austere and seemingly unfeeling man. A taste for botany had introduced them to each other, for they had frequently met in their wanderings among the mountains. M. Barrows had retired from the world, and almost from society, to live in a pleasant chateau, on the skirts of the woods, near La Vallée. He also had been disappointed in his opinion of mankind, but he did not, like Saint Aubert, pity and mourn for them, he felt more indignation at their vices, than compassion for their weaknesses. Saint Aubert was somewhat surprised to see him, for, though he had often pressed him to come to the chateau, he had never till now accepted the invitation, and now he came without ceremony or reserve, entering the parlor as an old friend. The claims of misfortune appeared to have softened down all the ruggedness and prejudices of his heart. Street Aubert unhappy, seemed to be the sole idea that occupied his mind. It was in manners, more than in words, that he appeared to sympathize with his friends. He spoke little on the subject of their grief, but the minute attention he gave them, and the modulated voice, and softened look that accompanied it, came from his heart, and spoke to theirs. At this melancholy period Saint Aubert was likewise visited by Madame Chiron, his only surviving sister, who had been some years a widow, and now resided on her own estate near the Laos. The intercourse between them had not been very frequent. In her condolements, words were not wanting. She understood not the magic of the look that speaks at once to the soul, or the voice that sinks like balm to the heart, but she assured Saint Aubert that she sincerely sympathized with him, praised the virtues of his late wife, and then offered what she considered to be consolation. Emily wept unceasingly while she spoke. Saint Aubert was tranquil, listened to what she said in silence, and then turned the discourse upon another subject. At parting she pressed him and her niece to make her an early visit. "Change of place will amuse you," said she, "and it is wrong to give way to grief." Saint Aubert acknowledged the truth of these words of course, but, at the same time, felt more reluctant than ever to quit the spot which his past happiness had consecrated. The presence of his wife had sanctified every surrounding scene, and, each day, as it gradually softened the acuteness of his suffering, assisted the tender enchantment that bound him to home. But there were calls which must be complied with, and of this kind was the visit he paid to his brother-in-law M. Canel. An affair of an interesting nature made it necessary that he should delay this visit no longer, and, wishing to rouse Emily from her dejection, he took her with him to Eporville. As the carriage entered upon the forest that adjoined his paternal domain, his eyes once more caught, between the Chestnut Avenue, the turned corners of the chateau. He sighed to think of what had passed since he was last there, and that it was now the property of a man who neither revered nor valued it. At length he entered the avenue, whose lofty trees had so often delighted him when a boy, and whose melancholy shade was now so congenial with the tone of his spirits. Every feature of the edifice, distinguished by an air of heavy grandeur, appeared successively between the branches of the trees, the broad turret, the arched gateway that led into the courts, the drawbridge, and the dry fosse which surrounded the whole. The sound of carriage wheels brought a troop of servants to the great gate, where Saint Aubert alighted, and from which he led Emily into the Gothic hall, now no longer hung with the arms and ancient banners of the family. These were displaced, and the oak wainscoting, and beams that crossed the roof, were painted white. The large table, too, that used to stretch along the upper end of the hall, where the master of the mansion loved to display his hospitality, and whence the peal of laughter, and the song of conviviality had so often resounded, was now removed. Even the benches that had surrounded the hall were no longer there. The heavy walls were hung with frivolous ornaments, and everything that appeared denoted the false taste and corrupted sentiments of the present owner. Saint Aubert followed a gay Parisian servant to a parlor, where sat Mons. And Madame Canel, who received him with a stately politeness, and, after a few formal words of condolement, seemed to have forgotten that they ever had a sister. Emily felt tears swell into her eyes, and then resentment checked them. Saint Aubert, calm and deliberate, preserved his dignity without assuming importance, and Quesnel was depressed by his presence without exactly knowing wherefore. After some general conversation, Saint Aubert requested to speak with him alone, and Emily, being left with Madame Quesnel, soon learned that a large party was invited to dine at the chateau, and was compelled to hear that nothing which was passed an irremediable ought to prevent the festivity of the present hour. Saint Aubert, when he was told that company were expected, felt a mixed emotion of disgust and indignation against the insensibility of Quesnel, which prompted him to return home immediately. But he was informed that Madame Chiron had been asked to meet him, and, when he looked at Emily, and considered that a time might come when the enmity of her uncle would be prejudicial to her, he determined not to incur it himself, by conduct which would be resented as indecorous, by the very persons who now showed so little sense of decorum. Among the visitors assembled at dinner were two Italian gentlemen, of whom one was named Montoni, a distant relation of Madame Quesnel, a man about 40, of an uncommonly handsome person, with features manly and expressive, but whose countenance exhibited, upon the whole, more of the haughtiness of command, and the quickness of discernment, than of any other character. Signor Cavini, his friend, appeared to be about 30, inferior in dignity, but equal to him in penetration of countenance, and superior in insinuation of manner. Emily was shocked by the salutation with which Madame Chiron met her father. "Dear brother," said she, "I am concerned to see you look so very ill. Do, pray, have advice." Saint Aubert answered, with a melancholy smile, that he felt himself much as usual, but Emily's fears made her now fancy that her father looked worse than he really did. Emily would have been amused by the new characters she saw, and the varied conversation that passed during dinner, which was served in a style of splendor she had seldom seen before, had her spirits been less oppressed. Of the guests, Signor Montoni was lately come from Italy, and he spoke of the commotions which at that period agitated the country, talked of party differences with warmth, and then lamented the probable consequences of the tumults. His friend spoke with equal ardor of the politics of his country, praised the government and prosperity of Venice, and boasted of its decided superiority over all the other Italian states. He then turned to the ladies, and talked with the same eloquence, of Parisian fashions, the French opera, and French manners, and on the latter subject he did not fail to mingle what is so particularly agreeable to French taste. The flattery was not detected by those to whom it was addressed, though its effect, in producing submissive attention, did not escape his observation. When he could disengage himself from the assiduities of the other ladies, he sometimes addressed Emily, but she knew nothing of Parisian fashions, or Parisian operas, and her modesty, simplicity, and correct manners formed a decided contrast to those of her female companions. After dinner, Saint Aubert stole from the room to view once more the old chestnut which Quesnel talked of cutting down. As he stood under its shade, and looked up among its branches, still luxuriant, and saw here and there the blue sky trembling between them, the pursuits and events of his early days crowded fast to his mind, with the figures and characters of friends, long since gone from the earth, and he now felt himself to be almost an insulated being, with nobody but his Emily for his heart to turn to. He stood lost amid the scenes of years which fancy called up, till the succession closed with the picture of his dying wife, and he started away, to forget it, if possible, at the social board. Saint Aubert ordered his carriage at an early hour, and Emily observed that he was more than usually silent and dejected on the way home, but she considered this to be the effect of his visit to a place which spoke so eloquently of former times, nor suspected that he had a cause of grief which he concealed from her. On entering the chateau she felt more depressed than ever, for she more than ever missed the presence of that dear parent, who, whenever she had been from home, used to welcome her return with smiles and fondness. Now, all was silent and forsaken. But what reason and effort may fail to do, time affects. Week after week passed away, and each, as it passed, stole something from the harshness of her affliction, till it was mellowed to that tenderness which the feeling heart cherishes as sacred. Saint Aubert, on the contrary, visibly declined in health, though Emily, who had been so constantly with him, was almost the last person who observed it. His constitution had never recovered from the late attack of the fever, and the succeeding shock it received from Madame Saint Aubert's death had produced its present infirmity. His physician now ordered him to travel, for it was perceptible that sorrow had seized upon his nerves, weakened as they had been by the preceding illness, and variety of scene, it was probable, would, by amusing his mind, restore them to their proper tone. For some days Emily was occupied in preparations to attend him, and he, by endeavors to diminish his expenses at home during the journey, a purpose which determined him at length to dismiss his domestics. Emily seldom opposed her father's wishes by questions or remonstrances, or she would now have asked why he did not take a servant, and have represented that his infirm health made one almost necessary. But when, on the eve of their departure, she found that he had dismissed Jacques, Francis, and Mary, and detained only Teresa the old housekeeper, she was extremely surprised, and ventured to ask his reason for having done so. "To save expenses, my dear," he replied, "we are going on an expensive excursion." The physician had prescribed the air of Languedoc and Provence, and St. Aubert determined, therefore, to travel leisurely along the shores of the Mediterranean, towards Provence. They retired early to their chamber on the night before their departure, but Emily had a few books and other things to collect, and the clock had struck 12 before she had finished, or had remembered that some of her drawing instruments, which she meant to take with her, were in the parlor below. As she went to fetch these, she passed her father's room, and, perceiving the door half open, concluded that he was in his study, for, since the death of Madame St. Aubert, it had been frequently his custom to rise from his restless bed, and go thither to compose his mind. When she was below stairs she looked into this room, but without finding him, and as she returned to her chamber, she tapped at his door, and receiving no answer, stepped softly in, to be certain whether he was there. The room was dark, but a light glimmered through some panes of glass that were placed in the upper part of a closet door. Emily believed her father to be in the closet, and, surprised that he was up at so late an hour, apprehended he was unwell, and was going to inquire, but, considering that her sudden appearance at this hour might alarm him, she removed her light to the staircase, and then stepped softly to the closet. On looking through the panes of glass, she saw him seated at a small table, with papers before him, some of which he was reading with deep attention and interest, during which he often wept and sobbed aloud. Emily, who had come to the door to learn whether her father was ill, was now detained there by a mixture of curiosity and tenderness. She could not witness his sorrow, without being anxious to know the subject of, and she therefore continued to observe him in silence, concluding that those papers were letters of her late mother. Presently he knelt down, and with a look so solemn as she had seldom seen him assume, and which was mingled with a certain wild expression, that partook more of horror than of any other character, he prayed silently for a considerable time. When he rose, a ghastly paleness was on his countenance. Emily was hastily retiring, but she saw him turn again to the papers, and she stopped. He took from among them a small case, and from thence a miniature picture. The rays of light fell strongly upon it, and she perceived it to be that of a lady, but not of her mother. St. Aubert gazed earnestly and tenderly upon his portrait, put it to his lips, and then to his heart, and sighed with a convulsive force. Emily could scarcely believe what she saw to be real. She never knew till now that he had a picture of any other lady than her mother, much less that he had one which he evidently valued so highly, but having looked repeatedly, to be certain that it was not the resemblance of Madame St. Aubert, she became entirely convinced that it was designed for that of some other person. At length St. Aubert returned the picture to its case, and Emily, recollecting that she was intruding upon his private sorrows, softly withdrew from the chamber. Chapter 3. Oh, how canst thou renounce the boundless store of charms which nature to her vitry yields? The warbling woodland, the resounding shore, the pomp of groves, and garniture of fields, all that the genial ray of morning gilds, and all that echoes to the song of even, all that the mountain's sheltering bosom shields, and all the dread magnificence of heaven, oh how canst thou renounce, and hope to be forgiven? These charms shall work thy soul's eternal health, and love, and gentleness, and joy, impart. The Minstrel. St. Aubert, instead of taking the more direct road, that ran along the feet of the Pyrenees to Languedoc, chose one that, winding over the heights, afforded more extensive views and greater variety of romantic scenery. He turned a little out of his way to take leave of M. Barros, whom he found botanizing in the wood near his chateau, and who, when he was told the purpose of St. Aubert's visit, expressed a degree of concern, such as his friend had thought it was scarcely possible for him to feel on any similar occasion. They parted with mutual regret. "If anything could have tempted me from my retirement," said M. Barros, "it would have been the pleasure of accompanying you on this little tour. I do not often offer compliments, you may, therefore, believe me, when I say, that I shall look for your return with impatience." The travelers proceeded on their journey. As they ascended the heights, St. Aubert often looked back upon the chateau, in the plain below, tender images crowded to his mind, his melancholy imagination suggested that he should return no more, and though he checked this wandering thought, still he continued to look, till the haziness of distance blended his home with the general landscape, and St. Aubert seemed to drag and each remove a lengthening chain. He and Emily continued sunk in musing silence for some leagues, from which melancholy reverie Emily first awoke, and her young fancy, struck with the grandeur of the objects around, gradually yielded to delightful impressions. The road now descended into glens, confined by stupendous walls of rock, gray and barren, except where shrubs fringed their summits, or patches of meager vegetation tinted their recesses, in which the wild goat was frequently browsing. And now, the way led to the lofty cliffs, from whence the landscape was seen extending in all its magnificence. Emily could not restrain her transport as she looked over the pine forests of the mountains upon the vast plains, that, enriched with woods, towns, blushing vines, and plantations of almonds, palms, and olives, stretched along, till their various colors melted in distance into one harmonious hue, that seemed to unite earth with heaven. Through the whole of this glorious scene the majestic Garonne wandered, descending from its source among the Pyrenees, and winding its blue waves towards the Bay of Biscay. The ruggedness of the unfrequented road often obliged the wanderers to alight from their little carriage, but they thought themselves amply repaid for this inconvenience by the grandeur of the scenes, and, while the muleteer led his animals slowly over the broken ground, the travelers had leisure to linger amid these solitudes, and to indulge the sublime reflections, which soften, while they elevate, the heart, and fill it with the certainty of a present God. Still the enjoyment of St. Aubert was touched with that pensive melancholy, which gives to every object a mellower tint, and breathes a sacred charm over all around. They had provided against part of the evil to be encountered from a want of convenient inns, by carrying a stock of provisions in the carriage, so that they might take refreshment on any pleasant spot, in the open air, and pass the nights wherever they should happen to meet with a comfortable cottage. For the mind, also, they had provided, by a work on botany, written by M. Barrows, and by several of the Latin and Italian poets, while Emily's pencil enabled her to preserve some of those combinations of forms, which charmed her at every step. The loneliness of the road, where, only now and then, a peasant was seen driving his mule, or some mountaineer children at play among the rocks, heightened the effect of the scenery. St. Aubert was so much struck with it, that he determined, if he could hear of a road, to penetrate further among the mountains, and, bending his way rather more to the south, to emerge into Rousillon, and coast the Mediterranean along part of that country to Languedoc. Soon after midday, they reached the summit of one of those cliffs, which, bright with the verdure of palm trees, adorn, like gems, the tremendous walls of the rocks, and which overlooked the greater part of Gascony, and part of Languedoc. Here was shade, and the fresh water of a spring, that, gliding among the turf, under the trees, thence precipitated itself from rock to rock, till its dashing murmurs were lost in the abyss, though its white foam was long seen amid the darkness of the pines below. This was a spot well suited for rest, and the travelers alighted to dine, while the mules were unharnessed to browse on the savory herbs that enriched this summit. It was some time before St. Aubert or Emily could withdraw their attention from the surrounding objects, so as to partake of their little repast. Seated in the shade of the palms, St. Aubert pointed out to her observation the course of the rivers, the situation of great towns, and the boundaries of provinces, which science, rather than the eye, enabled him to describe. Notwithstanding this occupation, when he had talked a while he suddenly became silent, thoughtful, and tears often swelled to his eyes, which Emily observed, and the sympathy of her own heart told her their cause. The scene before them bore some resemblance, though it was on a much grander scale, to a favorite one of the late Madame St. Aubert, within view of the fishing house. They both observed this, and thought how delighted she would have been with the present landscape, while they knew that her eyes must never, never more open upon this world. St. Aubert remembered the last time of his visiting that spot in company with her, and also the mournfully presaging thoughts which had then arisen in his mind, and were now, even thus soon, realized. The recollection subdued him, and he abruptly rose from his seat, and walked away to where no eye could observe his grief. When he returned, his countenance had recovered its usual serenity. He took Emily's hand, pressed it affectionately, without speaking, and soon after called to the muleteer, who sat at a little distance, concerning a road among the mountains towards Rousillon. Michael said, there were several that way, but he did not know how far they extended, or even whether they were passable, and St. Aubert, who did not intend to travel after sunset, asked what village they could reach about that time. The muleteer calculated that they could easily reach Mato, which was in their present road, but that, if they took a road that sloped more to the south, towards Rousillon, there was a hamlet, which he thought they could gain before the evening shut in. St. Aubert, after some hesitation, determined to take the latter course, and Michael, having finished his meal, and harnessed his mules, again set forward, but soon stopped, and Saint Aubert saw him doing homage to a cross that stood on a rock impending over their way. Having concluded his devotions, he smacked his whip in the air, and, in spite of the rough road, and the pain of his poor mules, which he had been lately lamenting, rattled, in a full gallop, along the edge of a precipice, which had made the eye dizzy to look down. Emily was terrified almost to fainting, and Saint Aubert, apprehending still greater danger from suddenly stopping the driver, was compelled to sit quietly, and trust his fate to the strength and discretion of the mules, who seemed to possess a greater portion of the latter quality than their master, for they carried the travelers safely into the valley, and there stopped upon the brink of the rivulet that watered it. Leaving the splendor of extensive prospects, they now entered this narrow valley screened by rocks on rocks piled, as if by magic spell, here scorched by lightnings, there with ivy green. The scene of barrenness was here and there interrupted by the spreading branches of the larch and cedar, which threw their gloom over the cliff, or athwart the torrent that rolled in the vale. No living creature appeared, except the lizard, scrambling among the rocks, and often hanging upon points so dangerous, that fancy shrunk from the view of them. This was such a scene as _Salvator_ would have chosen, had he then existed, for his canvas. Saint Aubert, impressed by the romantic character of the place, almost expected to see banditti start from behind some projecting rock, and he kept his hand upon the arms with which he always traveled. As they advanced, the valley opened, its savage features gradually softened, and, towards evening, they were among heathy mountains, stretched in far perspective, along which the solitary sheep bell was heard, and the voice of the shepherd calling his wandering flocks to the nightly fold. His cabin, partly shadowed by the cork tree and the ilex, which Saint Aubert observed to flourish in higher regions of the air than any other trees, except the fir, was all the human habitation that yet appeared. Along the bottom of this valley the most vivid verdure was spread, and, in the little hollow recesses of the mountains, under the shade of the oak and chestnut, herds of cattle were grazing. Groups of them, too, were often seen reposing on the banks of the rivulet, or laving their sides in the cool stream, and sipping its wave. The sun was now setting upon the valley, its last light gleamed upon the water, and heightened the rich yellow and purple tints of the heath and broom, that overspread the mountains. Saint Aubert inquired of Michael the distance to the hamlet he had mentioned, but the man could not with certainty tell, and Emily began to fear that he had mistaken the road. Here was no human being to assist, or direct them. They had left the shepherd and his cabin far behind, and the scene became so obscured in twilight, that the eye could not follow the distant perspective of the valley in search of a cottage, or a hamlet. A glow of the horizon still marked the west, and this was of some little use to the travelers. Michael seemed endeavoring to keep up his courage by singing. His music, however, was not of a kind to disperse melancholy. He sung, in a sort of chant, one of the most dismal ditties his present auditors had ever heard, and Saint Aubert at length discovered it to be a vesper hymn to his favorite saint. They traveled on, sunk in that thoughtful melancholy, with which twilight and solitude impress the mind. Michael had now ended his ditty, and nothing was heard but the drowsy murmur of the breeze among the woods, and its light flutter, as it blew freshly into the carriage. They were at length roused by the sound of firearms. Saint Aubert called to the muleteer to stop, and they listened. The noise was not repeated, but presently they heard a rustling among the brakes. Saint Aubert drew forth a pistol, and ordered Michael to proceed as fast as possible, who had not long obeyed, before a horn sounded, that made the mountains ring. He looked again from the window, and then saw a young man spring from the bushes into the road, followed by a couple of dogs. The stranger was in a hunter's dress. His gun was slung across his shoulders, the hunter's horn hung from his belt, and in his hand was a small pike, which, as he held it, added to the manly grace of his figure, and assisted the agility of his steps. After a moment's hesitation, Saint Aubert again stopped the carriage, and waited till he came up, that they might inquire concerning the hamlet they were in search of. The stranger informed him, that it was only half a league distant, that he was going thither himself, and would readily show the way. Saint Aubert thanked him for the offer, and, pleased with his chevalier-like air and open countenance, asked him to take a seat in the carriage, which the stranger, with an acknowledgement, declined, adding that he would keep pace with the mules. "But I fear you will be wretchedly accommodated," said he. "The inhabitants of these mountains are a simple people, who are not only without the luxuries of life, but almost destitute of what in other places are held to be its necessaries." "I perceive you are not one of its inhabitants, sir," said Saint Aubert. "No, sir, I am only a wanderer here." The carriage drove on, and the increasing dusk made the travelers very thankful that they had a guide. The frequent glens, too, that now opened among the mountains, would likewise have added to their perplexity. Emily, As she looked up, one of these saw something at a great distance like a bright cloud in the air. "What light is yonder, sir?" said she. Saint Aubert looked, and perceived that it was the snowy summit of a mountain, so much higher than any around it, that it still reflected the sun's rays, while those below lay in deep shade. At length, the village lights were seen to twinkle through the dusk, and, soon after, some cottages were discovered in the valley, or rather were seen by reflection in the stream, on whose margin they stood, and which still gleamed with the evening light. The stranger now came up, and Saint Aubert, on further inquiry, found not only that there was no inn in the place, but not any sort of house of public reception. The stranger, however, offered to walk on, and inquire for a cottage to accommodate them, for which further civility Saint Aubert returned his thanks, and said, that, as the village was so near, he would alight, and walk with him. Emily followed slowly in the carriage. On the way, Saint Aubert asked his companion what success he had had in the chase. "Not much, sir," he replied, "nor do I aim at it. I am pleased with the country, and mean to saunter away a few weeks among its scenes. My dogs I take with me more for companionship than for game. This dress, too, gives me an ostensible business, and procures me that respect from the people, which would, perhaps, be refused to a lonely stranger, who had no visible motive for coming among them." "I admire your taste," said Saint Aubert, "and, if I was a younger man, should like to pass a few weeks in your way exceedingly. I, too, am a wanderer, but neither my plan nor pursuits are exactly like yours. I go in search of health, as much as of amusement." Saint Aubert sighed, and paused, and then, seeming to recollect himself, he resumed, "If I can hear of a tolerable road, that shall afford decent accommodation, it is my intention to pass into Rousillon, and along the seashore to Long Dock. You, sir, seem to be acquainted with the country, and can, perhaps, give me information on the subject." The stranger said, that what information he could give was entirely at his service, and then mentioned a road rather more to the east, which led to a town, whence it would be easy to proceed into Rousillon. They now arrived at the village, and commenced their search for a cottage that would afford a night's lodging. In several, which they entered, ignorance, poverty, and mirth seemed equally to prevail, and the owners eyed Saint Aubert with a mixture of curiosity and timidity. Nothing like a bed could be found, and he had ceased to inquire for one, when Emily joined him, who observed the languor of her father's countenance, and lamented that he had taken a road so ill provided with the comforts necessary for an invalid. Other cottages, which they examined, seemed somewhat less savage than the former, consisting of two rooms, if such they could be called, the first of these occupied by mules and pigs, the second by the family, which generally consisted of 6 or 8 children, with their parents, who slept on beds of skins and dried beech leaves, spread upon a mud floor. Here, light was admitted, and smoke discharged, through an aperture in the roof, and here the scent of spirits, for the traveling smugglers, who haunted the Pyrenees, had made this rude people familiar with the use of liquors, was generally perceptible enough. Emily turned from such scenes, and looked at her father with anxious tenderness, which the young stranger seemed to observe, for, drawing Saint Aubert aside, he made him an offer of his own bed. "It is a decent one," said he, "when compared with what we have just seen, yet such as in other circumstances I should be ashamed to offer you." Saint Aubert acknowledged how much he felt himself obliged by this kindness, but refused to accept it, till the young stranger would take no denial. "Do not give me the pain of knowing, sir," said he, "that an invalid, like you, lies on hard skins, while I sleep in a bed. Besides, sir, your refusal wounds my pride. I must believe you think my offer unworthy your acceptance. Let me show you the way. I have no doubt my landlady can accommodate this young lady also." Saint Aubert at length consented, that, if this could be done, he would accept his kindness, though he felt rather surprised, that the stranger had proved himself so deficient in gallantry, as to administer to the repose of an infirm man, rather than to that of a very lovely young woman, for he had not once offered the room for Emily. But she thought not of herself, and the animated smile she gave him, told how much she felt herself obliged for the preference of her father. On their way, the stranger, whose name was Valancourt, stepped on first to speak to his hostess, and she came out to welcome Saint Aubert into a cottage, much superior to any he had seen. This good woman seemed very willing to accommodate the strangers, who were soon compelled to accept the only two beds in the place. Eggs and milk were the only food the cottage afforded, but against scarcity of provisions Saint Aubert had provided, and he requested Valancourt to stay, and partake with him of less homely fare, an invitation, which was readily accepted, and they passed an hour in intelligent conversation. Saint Aubert was much pleased with the manly frankness, simplicity, and keen susceptibility to the grandeur of nature, which his new acquaintance discovered, and, indeed, he had often been heard to say, that, without a certain simplicity of heart, this taste could not exist in any strong degree. The conversation was interrupted by a violent uproar without, in which the voice of the muleteer was heard above every other sound. Valancourt started from his seat, and went to inquire the occasion, but the dispute continued so long afterwards, that Saint Aubert went himself, and found Michael quarreling with the hostess, because she had refused to let his mules lie in a little room where he and three of her sons were to pass the night. The place was wretched enough, but there was no other for these people to sleep in, and, with somewhat more of delicacy than was usual among the inhabitants of this wild tract of country, she persisted in refusing to let the animals have the same underscore bed chamber underscore with her children. This was a tender point with the muleteer. His honor was wounded when his mules were treated with disrespect, and he would have received a blow, perhaps, with more meekness. He declared that his beasts were as honest beasts, and as good beasts, as any in the whole province, and that they had a right to be well treated wherever they went. "They are as harmless as lambs," said he, "if people don't affront them. I never knew them behave themselves amiss above once or twice in my life, and then they had good reason for doing so. Once, indeed, they kicked at a boy's leg that lay asleep in the stable, and broke it, but I told them they were out there, and by St. Anthony. I believe they understood me, for they never did so again." He concluded this eloquent harangue with protesting, that they should share with him, go where he would. The dispute was at length settled by Valancourt, who drew the hostess aside, and desired she would let the muleteer and his beasts have the place in question to themselves, while her son should have the bed of skins designed for him, for that he would wrap himself in his cloak, and sleep on the bench by the cottage door. But this she thought it her duty to oppose, and she felt it to be her inclination to disappoint the muleteer. Valancourt, however, was positive, and the tedious affair was at length settled. It was late when Saint Aubert and Emily retired to their rooms, and Valancourt to his station at the door, which, at this mild season, he preferred to a close cabin and a bed of skins. Saint Aubert was somewhat surprised to find in his room volumes of Homer, Horace, and Petrarch, but the name of Valancourt, written in them, told him to whom they belonged. Chapter 4. In truth he was a strange and wayward wight, fond of each gentle, and each dreadful scene. In darkness, and in storm he found delight, nor less than when on ocean waves serene the southern sun diffused his dazzling sheen. Even sad vicissitude amassed his soul, and if a sigh would sometimes intervene, and down his cheek a tear of pity roll, a sigh, a tear, so sweet, he wished not to control. The Minstrel. Saint Aubert awoke at an early hour, refreshed by sleep, and desirous to set forward. He invited the stranger to breakfast with him, and, talking again of the road, Valancourt said, that, some months past, he had travelled as far as Beaujeu, which was a town of some consequence on the way to Rousillon. He recommended it to Saint Aubert to take that route, and the latter determined to do so. "The road from this hamlet," said Valancourt, "and that to Beaujeu, part at the distance of about a league and a half from hence. If you will give me leave, I will direct your muleteer so far. I must wander somewhere, and your company would make this a pleasanter ramble than any other I could take." Saint Aubert thankfully accepted his offer, and they set out together, the young stranger on foot, for he refused the invitation of Saint Aubert to take a seat in his little carriage. The road wound along the feet of the mountains through a pastoral valley, bright with verdure, and varied with groves of dwarf oak, beech and sycamore, under whose branches herds of cattle reposed. The mountain ash too, and the weeping birch, often threw their pendant foliage over the steeps above, where the scanty soil scarcely concealed their roots, and where their light branches waved to every breeze that fluttered from the mountains. The travellers were frequently met at this early hour, for the sun had not yet risen upon the valley, by shepherds driving immense flocks from their folds to feed upon the hills. Saint Aubert had set out thus early, not only that he might enjoy the first appearance of sunrise, but that he might inhale the first pure breath of morning, which above all things is refreshing to the spirits of the invalid. In these regions it was particularly so, where an abundance of wild flowers and aromatic herbs breathed forth their essence on the air. The dawn, which softened the scenery with its peculiar grey tint, now dispersed, and Emily watched the progress of the day, first trembling on the tops of the highest cliffs, then touching them with splendid light, while their sides and the vale below were still wrapped in dewy mist. Meanwhile, the sullen grey of the eastern clouds began to blush, then to redden, and then to glow with a thousand colours, till the golden light darted over all the air, touched the lower points of the mountain's brow, and glanced in long sloping beams upon the valley and its stream. All nature seemed to have awakened from death into life, The spirit of Saint Aubert was renovated. His heart was full, he wept, and his thoughts ascended to the great Creator. Emily wished to trip along the turf, so green and bright with dew, and to taste the full delight of that liberty, which the Izzard seemed to enjoy as he bounded along the brow of the cliffs, while Valancourt often stopped to speak with the travellers, and with social feeling to point out to them the peculiar objects of his admiration. Saint Aubert was pleased with him. "Here is the real ingenuousness and ardor of youth," said he to himself, "this young man has never been at Paris." He was sorry when they came to the spot where the roads parted, and his heart took a more affectionate leave of him than is usual after so short an acquaintance. Valancourt talked long by the side of the carriage, seemed more than once to be going, but still lingered, and appeared to search anxiously for topics of conversation to account for his delay. At length he took leave. As he went, Saint Aubert observed him look with an earnest and pensive eye at Emily, who bowed to him with a countenance full of timid sweetness, while the carriage drove on. Street Aubert, for whatever reason, soon after looked from the window, and saw Valancourt standing upon the bank of the road, resting on his pike with folded arms, and following the carriage with his eyes. He waved his hand, and Valancourt, seeming to awake from his reverie, returned the salute, and started away. The aspect of the country now began to change, and the travellers soon found themselves among mountains covered from their base nearly to their summits with forests of gloomy pine, except where a rock of granite shot up from the vale, and lost its snowy top in the clouds. The rivulet, which had hitherto accompanied them, now expanded into a river, and, flowing deeply and silently along, reflected, as in a mirror, the blackness of the impending shades. Sometimes a cliff was seen lifting its bold head above the woods and the vapors that floated midway down the mountains, and sometimes a face of perpendicular marble rose from the water's edge, over which the larch threw his gigantic arms, here scathed with lightning, and there floating in luxuriant foliage. They continued to travel over a rough and unfrequented road, seeing now and then at a distance the solitary shepherd, with his dog, stalking along the valley, and hearing only the dashing of torrents, which the woods concealed from the eye, the long sullen murmur of the breeze, as it swept over the pines, or the notes of the eagle and the vulture, which were seen towering round the beetling cliff. Often, as the carriage moved slowly over uneven ground, Saint Aubert alighted, and amused himself with examining the curious plants that grew on the banks of the road, and with which these regions abound, while Emily, wrapped in high enthusiasm, wandered away under the shades, listening in deep silence to the lonely murmur of the woods. Neither village nor hamlet was seen for many leagues. The goatherd's or the hunter's cabin, perched among the cliffs of the rocks, were the only human habitations that appeared. The travellers again took their dinner in the open air, on a pleasant spot in the valley, under the spreading shade of cedars, and then set forward towards Beaujeu. The road now began to descend, and, leaving the pine forests behind, wound among rocky precipices. The evening twilight again fell over the scene, and the travellers were ignorant how far they might yet be from Beaujeu. Saint Aubert, however, conjectured that the distance could not be very great, and comforted himself with the prospect of travelling on a more frequented road after reaching that town, where he designed to pass the night. Mingled woods, and rocks, and heathy mountains were now seen obscurely through the dusk, but soon even these imperfect images faded in darkness. Michael proceeded with caution, for he could scarcely distinguish the road. His mules, however, seemed to have more sagacity, and their steps were sure. On turning the angle of a mountain, a light appeared at a distance, that illumined the rocks, and the horizon to a great extent. It was evidently a large fire, but whether accidental, or otherwise, there were no means of knowing. Saint Aubert thought it was probably kindled by some of the numerous banditti that infested the Pyrenees, and he became watchful and anxious to know whether the road passed near this fire. He had arms with him, which, on an emergency, might afford some protection, though certainly a very unequal one, against a band of robbers, so desperate too as those usually were who haunted these wild regions. While many reflections rose upon his mind, he heard a voice shouting from the road behind, and ordering the muleteer to stop. Street Aubert bade him proceed as fast as possible, but either Michael, or his mules were obstinate, for they did not quit the old pace. Horses' feet were now heard, a man rode up to the carriage, still ordering the driver to stop, and Saint Aubert, who could no longer doubt his purpose, was with difficulty able to prepare a pistol for his defense, when his hand was upon the door of the chaise. The man staggered on his horse, the report of the pistol was followed by a groan, and Saint Aubert's horror may be imagined, when in the next instant he thought he heard the faint voice of Valancourt. He now himself bade the muleteer stop, and, pronouncing the name of Valancourt, was answered in a voice that no longer suffered him to doubt. Saint Aubert, who instantly alighted and went to his assistance, found him still sitting on his horse, but bleeding profusely, and appearing to be in great pain, though he endeavored to soften the terror of Saint Aubert by assurances that he was not materially hurt, the wound being only in his arm. Saint Aubert, with the muleteer, assisted him to dismount, and he sat down on the bank of the road, where Saint Aubert tried to bind up his arm, but his hands trembled so excessively that he could not accomplish it, and, Michael being now gone in pursuit of the horse, which, on being disengaged from his rider, had galloped off, he called Emily to his assistance. Receiving no answer, he went to the carriage, and found her sunk on the seat in a fainting fit. Between the distress of this circumstance and that of leaving Valancourt bleeding, he scarcely knew what he did. He endeavored, however, to raise her, and called to Michael to fetch water from the rivulet that flowed by the road, but Michael was gone beyond the reach of his voice. Valancourt, who heard these calls, and also the repeated name of Emily, instantly understood the subject of his distress, and, almost forgetting his own condition, he hastened to her relief. She was reviving when he reached the carriage, and then, understanding that anxiety for him had occasioned her indisposition, he assured her, in a voice that trembled, but not from anguish, that his wound was of no consequence. While he said this, Saint Aubert turned round, and perceiving that he was still bleeding, the subject of his alarm changed again, and he hastily formed some handkerchiefs into a bandage. This stopped the effusion of the blood, but Saint Aubert, dreading the consequence of the wound, inquired repeatedly how far they were from Beaujeu, when, learning that it was at 2 leagues distance, his distress increased, since he knew not how Valancourt, in his present state, would bear the motion of the carriage, and perceived that he was already faint from loss of blood. When he mentioned the subject of his anxiety, Valancourt entreated that he would not suffer himself to be thus alarmed on his account, for that he had no doubt he should be able to support himself very well, and then he talked of the accident as a slight one. The muleteer being now returned with Valancourt's horse, assisted him into the chaise, and, as Emily was now revived, they moved slowly on towards Beaujeu. Saint Aubert, when he had recovered from the terror occasioned him by this accident, expressed surprise on seeing Valancourt, who explained his unexpected appearance by saying, "You, sir, renewed my taste for society, when you had left the hamlet, it did indeed appear a solitude. I determined, therefore, since my object was merely amusement, to change the scene, and I took this road, because I knew it led through a more romantic tract of mountains than the spot I have left. Besides," added he, hesitating for an instant, "I will own, and why should I not, that I had some hope of overtaking you. And I have made you a very unexpected return for the compliment," said Saint Aubert, who lamented again the rashness which had produced the accident, and explained the cause of his late alarm. But Valancourt seemed anxious only to remove from the minds of his companions every unpleasant feeling relative to himself, and, for that purpose, still struggled against a sense of pain, and tried to converse with gaiety. Emily meanwhile was silent, except when Valancourt particularly addressed her, and there was at those times a tremulous tone in his voice that spoke much. They were now so near the fire, which had long flamed at a distance on the blackness of night, that it gleamed upon the road, and they could distinguish figures moving about the blaze. The way winding still nearer, they perceived in the valley one of those numerous bands of gypsies, which at that period particularly haunted the wilds of the Pyrenees, and lived partly by plundering the traveller. Emily looked with some degree of terror on the savage countenances of these people, shown by the fire, which heightened the romantic effects of the scenery, as it threw a red dusky gleam upon the rocks and on the foliage of the trees, leaving heavy masses of shade in regions of obscurity, which the eye feared to penetrate. They were preparing their supper. A large pot stood by the fire, over which several figures were busy. The blaze discovered a rude kind of tent, round which many children and dogs were playing, and the whole formed a picture highly grotesque. The travellers saw plainly their danger. Valancourt was silent, but laid his hand on one of Saint Aubert's pistols. Saint Aubert drew forth another, and Michael was ordered to proceed as fast as possible. They passed the place, however, without being attacked, the rovers being probably unprepared for the opportunity, and too busy about their supper to feel much interest, at the moment, in anything besides. After a league and a half more, passed in darkness, the travellers arrived at Beaujeu, and drove up to the only inn the place afforded, which, though superior to any they had seen since they entered the mountains, was bad enough. The surgeon of the town was immediately sent for, if a surgeon he could be called, who prescribed for horses as well as for men, and shaved faces at least as dexterously as he set bones. After examining Valancourt's arm, and perceiving that the bullet had passed through the flesh without touching the bone, he dressed it, and left him with a solemn prescription of quiet, which his patient was not inclined to obey. The delight of ease had now succeeded to pain, for ease may be allowed to assume a positive quality when contrasted with anguish, and, his spirits thus reanimated, he wished to partake of the conversation of Saint Aubert and Emily, who, released from so many apprehensions, were uncommonly cheerful. Late as it was, however, Saint Aubert was obliged to go out with the landlord to buy meat for supper, and Emily, who, during this interval, had been absent as long as she could, upon excuses of looking to their accommodation, which she found rather better than she expected, was compelled to return, and converse with Valancourt alone. They talked of the character of the scenes they had passed, of the natural history of the country, of poetry, and of Saint Aubert, a subject on which Emily always spoke and listened to with peculiar pleasure. The travelers passed an agreeable evening, but Saint Aubert was fatigued with his journey, and, as Valancourt seemed again sensible of pain, they separated soon after supper. In the morning Saint Aubert found that Valancourt had passed a restless night, that he was feverish, and his wound very painful. The surgeon, when he dressed it, advised him to remain quietly at Beaujeu, advice which was too reasonable to be rejected. Saint Aubert, however, had no favorable opinion of this practitioner, and was anxious to commit Valancourt into more skillful hands, but learning, upon inquiry, that there was no town within several leagues which seemed more likely to afford better advice, he altered the plan of his journey, and determined to await the recovery of Valancourt, who, with somewhat more ceremony than sincerity, made many objections to this delay. By order of his surgeon, Valancourt did not go out of the house that day, but Saint Aubert and Emily surveyed with delight the environs of the town, situated at the feet of the Pyrenean Alps, that rose, some in abrupt precipices, and others swelling with woods of cedar, fir, and cypress, which stretched nearly to their highest summits. The cheerful green of the beech and mountain ash was sometimes seen, like a gleam of light, amidst the dark verdure of the forest, and sometimes a torrent poured its sparkling flood, high among the woods. Valancourt's indisposition detained the travelers at Beaujeu several days, during which interval Saint Aubert had observed his disposition and his talents with the philosophic inquiry so natural to him. He saw a frank and generous nature, full of ardor, highly susceptible of whatever is grand and beautiful, but impetuous, wild, and somewhat romantic. Valancourt had known little of the world. His perceptions were clear, and his feelings just, his indignation of an unworthy, or his admiration of a generous action, were expressed in terms of equal vehemence. Saint Aubert sometimes smiled at his warmth, but seldom checked it, and often repeated to himself, "This young man has never been at Paris." A sigh sometimes followed this silent ejaculation. He determined not to leave Valancourt till he should be perfectly recovered, and, as he was now well enough to travel, though not able to manage his horse, Saint Aubert invited him to accompany him for a few days in the carriage. This he the more readily did, since he had discovered that Valancourt was of a family of the same name in Gascony, with whose respectability he was well acquainted. The latter accepted the offer with great pleasure, and they again set forward among these romantic wilds about Rousillon. They travelled leisurely, stopping wherever a scene uncommonly grand appeared, frequently alighting to walk to an eminence, whither the mules could not go, from which the prospect opened in greater magnificence, and often sauntering over hillocks covered with lavender, wild thyme, juniper, and tamarisk, and under the shades of woods, between those boles they caught the long mountain vista, sublime beyond anything that Emily had ever imagined. Saint Aubert sometimes amused himself with botanizing, while Valancourt and Emily strolled on, he pointing out to her notice the objects that particularly charmed him, and reciting beautiful passages from such of the Latin and Italian poets as he had heard her admire. In the pauses of conversation, when he thought himself not observed, he frequently fixed his eyes pensively on her countenance, which expressed with so much animation the taste and energy of her mind, and when he spoke again, there was a peculiar tenderness in the tone of his voice, that defeated any attempt to conceal his sentiments. By degrees these silent pauses became more frequent, till Emily, only, betrayed an anxiety to interrupt them, and she, who had been hitherto reserved, would now talk again, and again, of the woods and the valleys and the mountains, to avoid the danger of sympathy and silence. From Beaujeu the road had constantly ascended, conducting the travelers into the higher regions of the air, where immense glaciers exhibited their frozen horrors, and eternal snow whitened the summits of the mountains. They often paused to contemplate these stupendous scenes, and, seated on some wild cliff, where only the ilex or the larch could flourish, looked over dark forests of fir, and precipices where human foot had never wandered, into the glen, so deep, that the thunder of the torrent, which was seen to foam along the bottom, was scarcely heard to murmur. Over these crags rose others of stupendous height, and fantastic shape, some shooting into cones, others impending far over their base, in huge masses of granite, along whose broken ridges was often lodged a weight of snow, that, trembling even to the vibration of a sound, threatened to bear destruction in its course to the vale. Around, on every side, far as the eye could penetrate, were seen only forms of grandeur, the long perspective of mountain tops, tinged with ethereal blue, or white with snow, valleys of ice, and forests of gloomy fir. The serenity and clearness of the air in these high regions were particularly delightful to the travelers. It seemed to inspire them with a finer spirit, and diffused an indescribable complacency over their minds. They had no words to express the sublime emotions they felt. A solemn expression characterized the feelings of Saint Aubert. Tears often came to his eyes, and he frequently walked away from his companions. Valancourt now and then spoke, to point to Emily's notice some feature of the scene. The thinness of the atmosphere, through which every object came so distinctly to the eye, surprised and deluded her, who could scarcely believe that objects, which appeared so near, were, in reality, so distant. The deep silence of these solitudes was broken only at intervals by the scream of the vultures, seen cowering round some cliff below, or by the cry of the eagle sailing high in the air, except when the travelers listened to the hollow thunder that sometimes muttered at their feet. While, above, the deep blue of the heavens was unobscured by the lightest cloud, halfway down the mountains, long billows of vapor were frequently seen rolling, now wholly excluding the country below, and now opening, and partially revealing its features. Emily delighted to observe the grandeur of these clouds as they changed in shape and tints, and to watch their various effect on the lower world, whose features, partly veiled, were continually assuming new forms of sublimity. After traversing these regions for many leagues, they began to descend towards Rousillon, and features of beauty then mingled with the scene. Yet the travelers did not look back without some regret to the sublime objects they had quitted, though the eye, fatigued with the extension of its powers, was glad to repose on the verdure of woods and pastures, that now hung on the margin of the river below, to view again the humble cottage shaded by cedars, the playful group of mountaineer children, and the flowery nooks that appeared among the hills. As they descended, they saw at a distance, on the right, one of the grand passes of the Pyrenees into Spain, gleaming with its battlements and towers to the splendor of the setting rays, yellow tops of woods coloring the steeps below, while far above aspired the snowy points of the mountains, still reflecting a rosy hue. Saint Aubert began to look out for the little town he had been directed to by the people of Beaujeu, and where he meant to pass the night, but no habitation yet appeared. Of its distance Valancourt could not assist him to judge, for he had never been so far along this chain of Alps before. There was, however, a road to guide them, and there could be little doubt that it was the right one, for, since they had left Beaujeu, there had been no variety of tracks to perplex or mislead. The sun now gave his last light, and Saint Aubert bade the muleteer proceed with all possible dispatch. He found, indeed, the lassitude of illness return upon him, after a day of uncommon fatigue, both of body and mind, and he longed for repose. His anxiety was not soothed by observing a numerous train, consisting of men, horses, and loaded mules, winding down the steeps of an opposite mountain, appearing and disappearing at intervals among the woods, so that its numbers could not be judged of. Something bright, like arms, glanced in the setting ray, and the military dress was distinguishable upon the men who were in the van, and on others scattered among the troop that followed. As these wound into the vale, the rear of the party emerged from the woods, and exhibited a band of soldiers. Saint Aubert's apprehensions now subsided. He had no doubt that the train before him consisted of smugglers, who, in conveying prohibited goods over the Pyrenees, had been encountered, and conquered by a party of troops. The travelers had lingered so long among the sublimer scenes of these mountains, that they found themselves entirely mistaken in their calculation that they could reach Montigny at sunset, but, as they wound along the valley, they saw, on a rude alpine bridge, that united two lofty crags of the glen, a group of mountaineer children, amusing themselves with dropping pebbles into a torrent below, and watching the stones plunge into the water, that threw up its white spray high in the air as it received them, and returned a sullen sound, which the echoes of the mountains prolonged. Under the bridge was seen a perspective of the valley, with its cataract descending among the rocks, and a cottage on a cliff, overshadowed with pines. It appeared, that they could not be far from some small town. Saint Aubert bade the muleteer stop, and then called to the children to inquire if he was near Montigny, but the distance, and the roaring of the waters, would not suffer his voice to be heard, and the crags, adjoining the bridge, were of such tremendous height and steepness, that to have climbed either would have been scarcely practicable to a person unacquainted with the ascent. Saint Aubert, therefore, did not waste more moments in delay. They continued to travel long after twilight had obscured the road, which was so broken, that, now thinking it safer to walk than to ride, they all alighted. The moon was rising, but her light was yet too feeble to assist them. While they stepped carefully on, they heard the vesper bell of a convent. The twilight would not permit them to distinguish anything like a building, but the sound seemed to come from some woods that overhung an acclivity to the right. Valancourt proposed to go in search of this convent. "If they will not accommodate us with a night's lodging," said he, "they may certainly inform us how far we are from Montigny, and direct us towards it." He was bounding forward, without waiting Saint Aubert's reply, when the latter stopped him. "I am very weary," said Saint Aubert, "and wish for nothing so much as for immediate rest. We will all go to the convent. Your good looks would defeat our purpose, but when they see mine and Emily's exhausted countenances, they will scarcely deny us repose." As he said this, he took Emily's arm within his, and, telling Michael to wait a while in the road with the carriage, they began to ascend towards the woods, guided by the bell of the convent. His steps were feeble, and Valancourt offered him his arm, which he accepted. The moon now threw a faint light over their path, and, soon after, enabled them to distinguish some towers rising above the tops of the woods. Still following the note of the bell, they entered the shade of those woods, lighted only by the moonbeams, that glided down between the leaves, and threw a tremulous uncertain gleam upon the steep track they were winding. The gloom and the silence that prevailed, except when the bell returned upon the air, together with the wildness of the surrounding scene, struck Emily with a degree of fear, which, however, the voice and conversation of Valancourt somewhat repressed. When they had been some time ascending, Saint Aubert complained of weariness, and they stopped to rest upon a little green summit, where the trees opened, and admitted the moonlight. He sat down upon the turf, between Emily and Valancourt. The bell had now ceased, and the deep repose of the scene was undisturbed by any sound, for the low dull murmur of some distant torrents might be said to soothe, rather than to interrupt, the silence. Before them, extended the valley they had quitted, its rocks, and woods to the left, just silvered by the rays, formed a contrast to the deep shadow that involved the opposite cliffs, whose fringed summits only were tipped with light, while the distant perspective of the valley was lost in the yellow mist of moonlight. The travelers sat for some time wrapped in the complacency which such scenes inspire. "These scenes," said Valancourt, "at length, soften the heart, like the notes of sweet music, and inspire that delicious melancholy which no person, who had felt it once, would resign for the gayest pleasures. They waken our best and purest feelings, disposing us to benevolence, pity, and friendship. Those whom I love, I always seem to love more in such an hour as this." His voice trembled, and he paused. Saint Aubert was silent. Emily perceived a warm tear fall upon the hand he held. She knew the object of his thoughts. Hers too had, for some time, been occupied by the remembrance of her mother. He seemed by an effort to rouse himself. "Yes," said he, with a half-suppressed sigh, "the memory of those we love, of times forever past. In such an hour as this steals upon the mind, like a strain of distant music in the stillness of night, all tender and harmonious as this landscape, sleeping in the mellow moonlight." After the pause of a moment, Saint Aubert added, "I have always fancied, that I thought with more clearness, and precision, at such an hour than at any other, and that heart must be insensible in a great degree, that does not soften to its influence. But many such there are." Valancourt sighed. "Are there, indeed, many such?" said Emily. "A few years hence, my Emily," replied Saint Aubert, "and you may smile at the recollection of that question, if you do not weep to it. But come, I am somewhat refreshed, let us proceed." Having emerged from the woods, they saw, upon a turfy hillock above, the convent of which they were in search. A high wall, that surrounded it, led them to an ancient gate, at which they knocked, and the poor monk, who opened it, conducted them into a small adjoining room, where he desired they would wait while he informed the superior of their request. In this interval, several friars came in separately to look at them, and at length the first monk returned, and they followed him to a room, where the superior was sitting in an armchair, with a large folio volume, printed in black letter, open on a desk before him. He received them with courtesy, though he did not rise from his seat, and, having asked them a few questions, granted their request. After a short conversation, formal and solemn on the part of the superior, they withdrew to the apartment where they were to sup, and Valancourt, whom one of the inferior friars civilly desired to accompany, went to seek Michael and his mules. They had not descended halfway down the cliffs before they heard the voice of the muleteer echoing far and wide. Sometimes he called on Saint Aubert, and sometimes on Valancourt, who having, at length, convinced him that he had nothing to fear either for himself or his master, and having disposed of him, for the night, in a cottage on the skirts of the woods, returned to sup with his friends, on such sober fare as the monks thought it prudent to set before them. While Saint Aubert was too much indisposed to share it, Emily, in her anxiety for her father, forgot herself, and Balancourt, silent and thoughtful, yet never inattentive to them, appeared particularly solicitous to accommodate and relieve Saint Aubert, who often observed, while his daughter was pressing him to eat, or adjusting the pillow she had placed in the back of his armchair, that Balancourt fixed on her a look of pensive tenderness, which he was not displeased to understand. They separated at an early hour, and retired to their respective apartments. Emily was shown to hers by a nun of the convent, whom she was glad to dismiss, for her heart was melancholy, and her attention so much abstracted, that conversation with a stranger was painful. She thought her father daily declining, and attributed his present fatigue more to the feeble state of his frame, than to the difficulty of the journey. A train of gloomy ideas haunted her mind, till she fell asleep. In about 2 hours after, she was awakened by the chiming of a bell, and then heard quick steps pass along the gallery, into which her chamber opened. She was so little accustomed to the manners of a convent, as to be alarmed by this circumstance. Her fears, ever alive for her father, suggested that he was very ill, and she rose in haste to go to him. Having paused, however, to let the persons in the gallery pass before she opened her door, her thoughts, in the meantime, recovered from the confusion of sleep, and she understood that the bell was the call of the monks to prayers. It had now ceased, and, all being again still, she forbore to go to St. Aubert's room. Her mind was not disposed for immediate sleep, and the moonlight, that shone into her chamber, invited her to open the casement, and look out upon the country. It was a still and beautiful night, the sky was unobscured by any cloud, and scarce a leaf of the woods beneath trembled in the air. As she listened, the midnight hymn of the monks rose softly from a chapel, that stood on one of the lower cliffs, a holy strain, that seemed to ascend through the silence of night to heaven, and her thoughts ascended with it. From the consideration of his works, her mind arose to the adoration of the deity, in his goodness and power, wherever she turned her view, whether on the sleeping earth, or to the vast regions of space, glowing with worlds beyond the reach of human thought, the sublimity of God, and the majesty of his presence appeared. Her eyes were filled with tears of awful love and admiration, and she felt that pure devotion, superior to all the distinctions of human system, which lifts the soul above this world, and seems to expand it into a nobler nature, such devotion as can, perhaps, only be experienced, when the mind, rescued, for a moment, from the humbleness of earthly considerations, aspires to contemplate his power in the sublimity of his works, and his goodness in the infinity of his blessings. Is it not now the hour, the holy hour, when to the cloudless height of yon starred concave climbs the full orb moon, and to this nether world in solemn stillness, gives sign, that, to the listening ear of heaven religion's voice should plead. The very babe knows this, and, chance awoked, his little hands lifts to the gods, and on his innocent couch calls down a blessing. Correcticus. The midnight chant of the monks soon after dropped into silence, but Emily remained at the casement, watching the setting moon, and the valley sinking into deep shade, and willing to prolong her present state of mind. At length she retired to her mattress, and sunk into tranquil slumber. Chapter 5. While in the rosy vale love breathed his infant sighs, from anguish free. Thomson. Saint Aubert, sufficiently restored by a night's repose to pursue his journey, set out in the morning, with his family and Balancourt, for Rousillon, which he hoped to reach before nightfall. The scenes, through which they now passed, were as wild and romantic, as any they had yet observed, with this difference, that beauty, every now and then, softened the landscape into smiles. Little woody recesses appeared among the mountains, covered with bright verdure and flowers, or a pastoral valley opened its grassy bosom in the shade of the cliffs, with flocks and herds loitering along the banks of a rivulet, that refreshed it with perpetual green. Saint Aubert could not repent the having taken this fatiguing road, though he was this day, also, frequently obliged to alight, to walk along the rugged precipice, and to climb the steep and flinty mountain. The wonderful sublimity and variety of the prospects repaid him for all this, and the enthusiasm, with which they were viewed by his young companions, heightened his own, and awakened a remembrance of all the delightful emotions of his early days, when the sublime charms of nature were first unveiled to him. He found great pleasure in conversing with Valancourt, and in listening to his ingenuous remarks. The fire and simplicity of his manners seemed to render him a characteristic figure in the scenes around them, and Saint Aubert discovered in his sentiments the justness and the dignity of an elevated mind, unbiased by intercourse with the world. He perceived that his opinions were formed, rather than imbibed, were more the result of thought than of learning. Of the world he seemed to know nothing, for he believed well of all mankind, and this opinion gave him the reflected image of his own heart. Saint Aubert, as he sometimes lingered to examine the wild plants in his path, often looked forward with pleasure to Emily and Valancourt, as they strolled on together, he, with the countenance of animated delight, pointing to her attention some grand feature of the scene, and she, listening and observing with a look of tender seriousness, that spoke the elevation of her mind. They appeared like two lovers who had never strayed beyond these their native mountains, whose situation had secluded them from the frivolities of common life, whose ideas were simple and grand, like the landscapes among which they moved, and who knew no other happiness than in the union of pure and affectionate hearts. Saint Aubert smiled, and sighed at the romantic picture of felicity his fancy drew, and sighed again to think that nature and simplicity were so little known to the world, as that their pleasures were thought romantic. "The world," said he, pursuing this train of thought, "ridicules a passion which it seldom feels. Its scenes, and its interests, distract the mind, deprave the taste, corrupt the heart, and love cannot exist in a heart that has lost the meek dignity of innocence. Virtue and taste are nearly the same, for virtue is little more than active taste, and the most delicate affections of each combine in real love. How then are we to look for love in great cities, where selfishness, dissipation, and insincerity supply the place of tenderness, simplicity and truth?" It was near noon, when the travelers, having arrived at a piece of steep and dangerous road, alighted to walk. The road wound up an ascent, that was clothed with wood, and, instead of following the carriage, they entered the refreshing shade. A dewy coolness was diffused upon the air, which, with the bright verdure of turf, that grew under the trees, the mingled fragrance of flowers and of balm, thyme, and lavender, that enriched it, and the grandeur of the pines, beech, and chestnuts, that overshadowed them, rendered this a most delicious retreat. Sometimes, the thick foliage excluded all view of the country, at others, it admitted some partial catches of the distant scenery, which gave hints to the imagination to picture landscapes more interesting, more impressive, than any that had been presented to the eye. The wanderers often lingered to indulge in these reveries of fancy. The pauses of silence, such as had formerly interrupted the conversations of Valancourt and Emily, were more frequent today than ever. Valancourt often dropped suddenly from the most animating vivacity into fits of deep musing, and there was, sometimes, an unaffected melancholy in his smile, which Emily could not avoid understanding, for her heart was interested in the sentiment it spoke. Saint Aubert was refreshed by the shades, and they continued to saunter under them, following, as nearly as they could guess, the direction of the road, till they perceived that they had totally lost it. They had continued near the brow of the precipice, allured by the scenery it exhibited, while the road wound far away over the cliff above. Valancourt called loudly to Michael, but heard no voice, except his own, echoing among the rocks, and his various efforts to regain the road were equally unsuccessful. While they were thus circumstanced, they perceived a shepherd's cabin, between the boles of the trees at some distance, and Valancourt bounded on first to ask assistance. When he reached it, he saw only two little children, at play, on the turf before the door. He looked into the hut, but no person was there, and the eldest of the boys told him that their father was with his flocks, and their mother was gone down into the vale, but would be back presently. As he stood, considering what was further to be done, on a sudden he heard Michael's voice roaring forth most manfully among the cliffs above, till he made their echoes ring. Valancourt immediately answered the call, and endeavored to make his way through the thicket that clothed the steeps, following the direction of the sound. After much struggle over brambles and precipices, he reached Michael, and at length prevailed with him to be silent, and to listen to him. The road was at a considerable distance from the spot where Saint Aubert and Emily were. The carriage could not easily return to the entrance of the wood, and, since it would be very fatiguing for Saint Aubert to climb the long and steep road to the place where it now stood, Valancourt was anxious to find a more easy ascent, by the way he had himself passed. Meanwhile Saint Aubert and Emily approached the cottage, and rested themselves on a rustic bench, fastened between two pines, which overshadowed it, till Valancourt, whose steps they had observed, should return. The eldest of the children desisted from his play, and stood still to observe the strangers, while the younger continued his little gambols, and teased his brother to join in them. Saint Aubert looked with pleasure upon this picture of infantine simplicity, till it brought to his remembrance his own boys, whom he had lost about the age of these, and their lamented mother, and he sunk into a thoughtfulness, which Emily observing, she immediately began to sing one of those simple and lively airs he was so fond of, and which she knew how to give with the most captivating sweetness. Saint Aubert smiled on her through his tears, took her hand and pressed it affectionately, and then tried to dissipate the melancholy reflections that lingered in his mind. While she sung, Valancourt approached, who was unwilling to interrupt her, and paused at a little distance to listen. When she had concluded, he joined the party, and told them, that he had found Michael, as well as a way, by which he thought they could ascend the cliff to the carriage. He pointed to the woody steeps above, which St. Aubert surveyed with an anxious eye. He was already wearied by his walk, and this ascent was formidable to him. He thought, however, it would be less toilsome than the long and broken road, and he determined to attempt it. But Emily, ever watchful of his ease, proposing that he should rest, and dine before they proceeded further, Valancourt went to the carriage for the refreshments deposited there. On his return, he proposed removing a little higher up the mountain, to where the woods opened upon a grand and extensive prospect, and thither they were preparing to go, when they saw a young woman join the children, and caress and weep over them. The travelers, interested by her distress, stopped to observe her. She took the youngest of the children in her arms, and, perceiving the strangers, hastily dried her tears, and proceeded to the cottage. St. Aubert, on inquiring the occasion of her sorrow, learned that her husband, who was a shepherd, and lived here in the summer months to watch over the flocks he led to feed upon these mountains, had lost, on the preceding night, his little all. A gang of gypsies, who had for some time infested the neighborhood, had driven away several of his master's sheep. Jacques, added the shepherd's wife, had saved a little money, and had bought a few sheep with it, and now they must go to his master for those that are stolen, and what is worse than all, his master, when he comes to know how it is, will trust him no longer with the care of his flocks, for he is a hard man. And then what is to become of our children? The innocent countenance of the woman, and the simplicity of her manner in relating her grievance, inclined St. Aubert to believe her story, and Valancourt, convinced that it was true, asked eagerly what was the value of the stolen sheep, on hearing which he turned away with a look of disappointment. St. Aubert put some money into her hand, Emily too gave something from her little purse, and they walked towards the cliff, but Valancourt lingered behind, and spoke to the shepherd's wife, who was now weeping with gratitude and surprise. He inquired how much money was yet wanting to replace the stolen sheep, and found, that it was a sum very little short of all he had about him. He was perplexed and distressed. This sum then, said he to himself, would make this poor family completely happy, it is in my power to give it, to make them completely happy. But what is to become of me? How shall I contrive to reach home with the little money that will remain? For a moment he stood, unwilling to forego the luxury of raising a family from ruin to happiness, yet considering the difficulties of pursuing his journey with so small a sum as would be left. While he was in this state of perplexity, the shepherd himself appeared, his children ran to meet him, he took one of them in his arms, and, with the other clinging to his coat, came forward with a loitering step. His forlorn and melancholy look determined Valancourt at once, he threw down all the money he had, except a very few louis, and bounded away after St. Aubert and Emily, who were proceeding slowly up the steep. Valancourt had seldom felt his heart so light as at this moment, his gay spirits danced with pleasure, every object around him appeared more interesting, or beautiful, than before. St. Aubert observed the uncommon vivacity of his countenance, "What has pleased you so much?" said he. "Oh, what a lovely day," replied Valancourt, "how brightly the sun shines, how pure is this air, what enchanting scenery." "It is indeed enchanting," said St. Aubert, whom early experience had taught to understand the nature of Valancourt's present feelings. "What pity that the wealthy, who can command such sunshine, should ever pass their days in gloom, in the cold shade of selfishness. For you, my young friend, may the sun always shine as brightly as at this moment, may your own conduct always give you the sunshine of benevolence and reason united." Valancourt, highly flattered by this compliment, could make no reply but by a smile of gratitude. They continued to wind under the woods, between the grassy knolls of the mountain, and, as they reached the shady summit, which he had pointed out, the whole party burst into an exclamation. Behind the spot where they stood, the rock rose perpendicularly in a massy wall to a considerable height, and then branched out into overhanging crags. Their gray tints were well contrasted by the bright hues of the plants and wildflowers, that grew in their fractured sides, and were deepened by the gloom of the pines and cedars, that waved above. The steeps below, over which the eye passed abruptly to the valley, were fringed with thickets of alpine shrubs, and, lower still, appeared the tufted tops of the chestnut woods, that clothed their base, among which peeped forth the shepherd's cottage, just left by the travelers, with its bluish smoke curling high in the air. On every side appeared the majestic summits of the Pyrenees, some exhibiting tremendous crags of marble, whose appearance was changing every instant, as the varying lights fell upon their surface, others, still higher, displaying only snowy points, while their lower steeps were covered almost invariably with forests of pine, larch, and oak, that stretched down to the vale. This was one of the narrow valleys that opened from the Pyrenees into the country of Rousillon, and whose green pastures and cultivated beauty form a decided and wonderful contrast to the romantic grandeur that environs it. Through a vista of the mountains appeared the lowlands of Rousillon, tinted with the blue haze of distance, as they united with the waters of the Mediterranean, where, on a promontory, which marked the boundary of the shore, stood a lonely beacon, over which were seen circling flights of sea fowl. Beyond, appeared, now and then, a stealing sail, white with the sunbeam, and whose progress was perceivable by its approach to the lighthouse. Sometimes, too, was seen a sail so distant that it served only to mark the line of separation between the sky and the waves. On the other side of the valley, immediately opposite to the spot where the travelers rested, a rocky pass opened toward Gascony. Here no sign of cultivation appeared. The rocks of granite that screened the glen rose abruptly from their base and stretched their barren points to the clouds, unvaried with woods and uncheered even by a hunter's cabin. Sometimes, indeed, a gigantic larch threw its long shade over the precipice, and here and there a cliff reared on its brow a monumental cross, to tell the traveler the fate of him who had ventured thither before. This spot seemed the very haunt of banditti, and Emily, as she looked down upon it, almost expected to see them stealing out from some hollow cave to look for their prey. Soon after, an object not less terrific struck her: a gibbet standing on a point of rock near the entrance of the pass, and immediately over one of the crosses she had before observed. These were hieroglyphics that told a plain and dreadful story. She forbore to point it out to St. Aubert, but it threw a gloom over her spirits, and made her anxious to hasten forward, that they might with certainty reach Rousillon before nightfall. It was necessary, however, that St. Aubert should take some refreshment, and, seating themselves on the short dry turf, they opened the basket of provisions, while, by breezy murmurs cooled, broad or underscore their underscore heads the verdant cedars wave, and high pombos lift their graceful shade. Dash underscore they underscore draw ethereal soul, their drink reviving gales profusely breathing from the piney groves, and veils of fragrance, there at a distance hear the roaring floods, and cataracts. Thomson. St. Aubert was revived by rest, and by the serene air of this summit, and Valancourt was so charmed with all around, and with the conversation of his companions, that he seemed to have forgotten he had any further to go. Having concluded their simple repast, they gave a long farewell look to the scene, and again began to ascend. St. Aubert rejoiced when he reached the carriage, which Emily entered with him, but Valancourt, willing to take a more extensive view of the enchanting country, into which they were about to descend, than he could do from a carriage, loosened his dogs, and once more bounded with them along the banks of the road. He often quitted it for points that promised a wider prospect, and the slow pace, at which the mules traveled, allowed him to overtake them with ease. Whenever a scene of uncommon magnificence appeared, he hastened to inform St. Aubert, who, though he was too much tired to walk himself, sometimes made the chaise wait, while Emily went to the neighboring cliff. It was evening when they descended the lower Alps, that bind Rousillon, and form a majestic barrier round the charming country, leaving it open only on the east to the Mediterranean. The gay tints of cultivation once more beautified the landscape, for the lowlands were colored with the richest hues, which a luxuriant climate, and an industrious people can awaken into life. Groves of orange and lemon perfumed the air, their ripe fruit glowing among the foliage, while, sloping to the plains, extensive vineyards spread their treasures. Beyond these, woods and pastures, and mingled towns and hamlets stretched towards the sea, on whose bright surface gleamed many a distant sail, while, over the whole scene, was diffused the purple glow of evening. This landscape with the surrounding Alps did, indeed, present a perfect picture of the lovely and the sublime, a beauty sleeping in the lap of horror. The travelers, having reached the plains, proceeded, between hedges of flowering myrtle and pomegranate, to the town of Arles, where they proposed to rest for the night. They met with simple, but neat accommodation, and would have passed a happy evening, after the toils and the delights of this day, had not the approaching separation thrown a gloom over their spirit. It was St. Aubert's plan to proceed, on the morrow, to the borders of the Mediterranean, and travel along its shores into Languedoc, and Valancourt, since he was now nearly recovered, and had no longer a pretense for continuing with his new friends, resolved to leave them here. St. Aubert, who was much pleased with him, invited him to go further, but did not repeat the invitation, and Valancourt had resolution enough to forego the temptation of accepting it, that he might prove himself not unworthy of the favor. On the following morning, therefore, they were to part, St. Aubert to pursue his way to Languedoc, and Balancourt to explore new scenes among the mountains, on his return home. During this evening he was often silent and thoughtful. Saint Aubert's manner towards him was affectionate, though grave, and Emily was serious, though she made frequent efforts to appear cheerful. After one of the most melancholy evenings they had yet passed together, they separated for the night. Chapter 6. I care not, fortune, what you meet and I, you cannot rob me of free nature's grace, you cannot shut the windows of the sky, through which Aurora shows her brightening face, you cannot bar my constant feet to trace the woods and lawns, by living stream, at eve, let health my nerves and finer fibers brace, and I their toys to the great children leave, of fancy, reason, virtue, naught can me bereave. Thomson. In the morning, Valancourt breakfasted with Saint Aubert and Emily, neither of whom seemed much refreshed by sleep. The languor of illness still hung over Saint Aubert, and to Emily's fears his disorder appeared to be increasing fast upon him. She watched his looks with anxious affection, and their expression was always faithfully reflected in her own. At the commencement of their acquaintance, Valancourt had made known his name and family. Saint Aubert was not a stranger to either, for the family estates, which were now in the possession of an elder brother of Valancourt, were little more than 20 miles distant from La Vallée, and he had sometimes met the elder Valancourt on visits in the neighborhood. This knowledge had made him more willingly receive his present companion, for, though his countenance and manners would have won him the acquaintance of Saint Aubert, who was very apt to trust to the intelligence of his own eyes, with respect to countenances, he would not have accepted these, as sufficient introductions to that of his daughter. The breakfast was almost as silent as the supper of the preceding night, but their musing was at length interrupted by the sound of the carriage wheels, which were to bear away Saint Aubert and Emily. Valancourt started from his chair, and went to the window. It was indeed the carriage, and he returned to his seat without speaking. The moment was now come when they must part. Saint Aubert told Valancourt that he hoped he would never pass La Vallée without favoring him with a visit, and Valancourt, eagerly thanking him, assured him that he never would, as he said which he looked timidly at Emily, who tried to smile away the seriousness of her spirits. They passed a few minutes in interesting conversation, and Saint Aubert then led the way to the carriage, Emily and Valancourt following in silence. The latter lingered at the door several minutes after they were seated, and none of the party seemed to have courage enough to say, farewell. At length, Saint Aubert pronounced the melancholy word, which Emily passed to Valancourt, who returned it, with a dejected smile, and the carriage drove on. The travelers remained, for some time, in a state of tranquil pensiveness, which is not unpleasing. Saint Aubert interrupted it by observing, "This is a very promising young man. It is many years since I have been so much pleased with any person, on so short an acquaintance. He brings back to my memory the days of my youth, when every scene was new and delightful." Saint Aubert sighed, and sunk again into a reverie, and, as Emily looked back upon the road they had passed, Valancourt was seen, at the door of the little inn, following them with his eyes. He perceived her, and waved his hand, and she returned the adieu, till the winding road shut her from his sight. "I remember when I was about his age," resumed Saint Aubert, "and I thought, and felt exactly as he does. The world was opening upon me then, now, it is closing." "My dear sir, do not think so gloomily," said Emily in a trembling voice. "I hope you have many, many years to live, for your own sake, for my sake. "Ah, my Emily," replied Saint Aubert, "for thy sake. Well, I hope it is so." He wiped away a tear, that was stealing down his cheek, threw a smile upon his countenance, and said in a cheering voice, "There is something in the ardor and ingenuousness of youth, which is particularly pleasing to the contemplation of an old man, if his feelings have not been entirely corroded by the world. It is cheering and reviving, like the view of spring to a sick person. His mind catches somewhat of the spirit of the season, and his eyes are lighted up with a transient sunshine. Valancourt is this spring to me." Emily, who pressed her father's hand affectionately, had never before listened with so much pleasure to the praises he bestowed, no, not even when he had bestowed them on herself. They traveled on, among vineyards, woods, and pastures, delighted with the romantic beauty of the landscape, which was bounded, on one side, by the grandeur of the Pyrenees, and, on the other, by the ocean, and, soon after noon, they reached the town of Colliure, situated on the Mediterranean. Here they dined, and rested till towards the cool of day, when they pursued their way along the shores, those enchanting shores, which extend to Languedoc. Emily gazed with enthusiasm on the vastness of the sea, its surface varying, as the lights and shadows fell, and on its woody banks, mellowed with autumnal tints. Saint Aubert was impatient to reach Perpignan, where he expected letters from M. Quesnel, And it was the expectation of these letters that had induced him to leave Colioure, for his feeble frame had required immediate rest. After traveling a few miles, he fell asleep, and Emily, who had put two or three books into the carriage, on leaving La Vallée, had now the leisure for looking into them. She sought for one, in which Valancourt had been reading the day before, and hoped for the pleasure of retracing a page, over which the eyes of a beloved friend had lately passed, of dwelling on the passages, which he had admired, and of permitting them to speak to her in the language of his own mind, and to bring himself to her presence. On searching for the book, she could find it nowhere, but in its stead perceived a volume of Petrarch's poems, that had belonged to Valancourt, whose name was written in it, and from which he had frequently read passages to her, with all the pathetic expression, that characterized the feelings of the author. She hesitated in believing, what would have been sufficiently apparent to almost any other person, that he had purposely left this book, instead of the one she had lost, and that love had prompted the exchange, but, having opened it with impatient pleasure, and observed the lines of his pencil drawn along the various passages he had read aloud, and under others more descriptive of delicate tenderness than he had dared to trust his voice with, the conviction came, at length, to her mind. For some moments she was conscious only of being beloved, then, a recollection of all the variations of tone and countenance, with which he had recited these sonnets, and of the soul, which spoke in their expression, pressed to her memory, and she wept over the memorial of his affection. They arrived at Perpignan soon after sunset, where Saint Aubert found, as he had expected, letters from M. Canal, the contents of which so evidently and grievously affected him, that Emily was alarmed, and pressed him, as far as her delicacy would permit, to disclose the occasion of his concern, but he answered her only by tears, and immediately began to talk on other topics. Emily, though she forbore to press the one most interesting to her, was greatly affected by her father's manner, and passed a night of sleepless solicitude. In the morning they pursued their journey along the coast towards Lucate, another town on the Mediterranean, situated on the borders of Languedoc and Roussillon. On the way, Emily renewed the subject of the preceding night, and appeared so deeply affected by Saint Aubert's silence and dejection, that he relaxed from his reserve. "I was unwilling, my dear Emily," said he, "to throw a cloud over the pleasure you receive from these scenes, and meant, therefore, to conceal, for the present, some circumstances, with which, however, you must at length have been made acquainted. But your anxiety has defeated my purpose. You suffer as much from this, perhaps, as you will do from a knowledge of the facts I have to relate. M. Canel's visit proved an unhappy one to me. He came to tell me part of the news he has now confirmed. You may have heard me mention a M. Medville, of Paris, but you did not know that the chief of my personal property was invested in his hands. I had great confidence in him, and I am yet willing to believe, that he is not wholly unworthy of my esteem. A variety of circumstances have concurred to ruin him, and, I am ruined with him." Saint Aubert paused to conceal his emotion. "The letters I have just received from M. Canal," resumed he, struggling to speak with firmness, "enclosed others from Medville, which confirmed all I dreaded." "Must we then quit La Vallée?" said Emily, after a long pause of silence. "That is yet uncertain," replied Saint Aubert. "It will depend upon the compromise Medville is able to make with his creditors. My income, you know, was never large, and now it will be reduced to little indeed. It is for you, Emily, for you, my child, that I am most afflicted." His last words faltered. Emily smiled tenderly upon him through her tears, and then, endeavoring to overcome her emotion, "My dear father," said she, "do not grieve for me, or for yourself. We may yet be happy. If La Vallée remains for us, we must be happy. We will retain only one servant, and you shall scarcely perceive the change in your income. Be comforted, my dear sir, we shall not feel the want of those luxuries, which others value so highly, since we never had a taste for them, and poverty cannot deprive us of many consolations. It cannot rob us of the affection we have for each other, or degrade us in our own opinion, or in that of any person, whose opinion we ought to value." Saint Aubert concealed his face with his handkerchief, and was unable to speak, but Emily continued to urge to her father the truths, which himself had impressed upon her mind. "Besides, my dear sir, poverty cannot deprive us of intellectual delights. It cannot deprive you of the comfort of affording me examples of fortitude and benevolence, nor me of the delight of consoling a beloved parent. It cannot deaden our taste for the grand, and the beautiful, or deny us the means of indulging it, for the scenes of nature, those sublime spectacles, so infinitely superior to all artificial luxuries, are open for the enjoyment of the poor, as well as of the rich. Of what, then, have we to complain, so long as we are not in want of necessaries? pleasures, such as wealth cannot buy, will still be ours. We retain, then, the sublime luxuries of nature, and lose only the frivolous ones of art." Saint Aubert could not reply. He caught Emily to his bosom, their tears flowed together, but they were not tears of sorrow. After this language of the heart, all other would have been feeble, and they remained silent for some time. Then, Saint Aubert conversed as before, for, if his mind had not recovered its natural tranquility, it at least assumed the appearance of it. They reached the romantic town of Lewicate early in the day, but Saint Aubert was weary, and they determined to pass the night there. In the evening, he exerted himself so far as to walk with his daughter to view the environs that overlook the Lake of Lewicate, the Mediterranean, part of Rousillon, with the Pyrenees, and a wide extent of the luxuriant province of Languedoc, now blushing with the ripened vintage, which the peasants were beginning to gather. Saint Aubert and Emily saw the busy groups, caught the joyous song, that was wafted on the breeze, and anticipated, with apparent pleasure, their next day's journey over this gay region. He designed, however, still to wind along the seashore. To return home immediately was partly his wish, but from this he was withheld by a desire to lengthen the pleasure, which the journey gave his daughter, and to try the effect of the sea air on his own disorder. On the following day, therefore, they recommenced their journey through Languedoc, winding the shores of the Mediterranean, the Pyrenees still forming the magnificent background of their prospects, while on their right was the ocean, and, on their left, wide extended plains melting into the blue horizon. Saint Aubert was pleased, and conversed much with Emily, yet his cheerfulness was sometimes artificial, and sometimes a shade of melancholy would steal upon his countenance, and betray him. This was soon chased away by Emily's smile, who smiled, however, with an aching heart, for she saw that his misfortunes preyed upon his mind, and upon his enfeebled frame. It was evening when they reached a small village of Upper Languedoc, where they meant to pass the night, but the place could not afford them beds, for here, too, it was the time of the vintage, and they were obliged to proceed to the next post. The languor of illness and of fatigue, which returned upon Saint Aubert, required immediate repose, and the evening was now far advanced, but from necessity there was no appeal, and he ordered Michael to proceed. The rich plains of Languedoc, which exhibited all the glories of the vintage, with the gaieties of a French festival, no longer awakened Saint Aubert to pleasure, whose condition formed a mournful contrast to the hilarity and youthful beauty which surrounded him. As his languid eyes moved over the scene, he considered that they would soon, perhaps, be closed forever on this world. Those distant and sublime mountains, said he secretly, as he gazed on a chain of the Pyrenees that stretched towards the west, these luxuriant plains, this blue vault, the cheerful light of day, will be shut from my eyes. The song of the peasant, the cheering voice of man, will no longer sound for me. The intelligent eyes of Emily seemed to read what passed in the mind of her father, and she fixed them on his face, with an expression of such tender pity, as recalled his thoughts from every desultory object of regret, and he remembered only, that he must leave his daughter without protection. This reflection changed regret to agony. He sighed deeply, and remained silent, while she seemed to understand that sigh, for she pressed his hand affectionately, and then turned to the window to conceal her tears. The sun now threw a last yellow gleam on the waves of the Mediterranean, and the gloom of twilight spread fast over the scene, till only a melancholy ray appeared on the western horizon, marking the point where the sun had set amid the vapors of an autumnal evening. A cool breeze now came from the shore, and Emily let down the glass, but the air, which was refreshing to health, was as chilling to sickness, and Saint Aubert desired that the window might be drawn up. Increasing illness made him now more anxious than ever to finish the day's journey, and he stopped the muleteer to inquire how far they had yet to go to the next post. He replied, 9 miles. I feel I am unable to proceed much further, said Saint Aubert. Inquire, as you go, if there is any house on the road that would accommodate us for the night. He sunk back in the carriage, and Michael, cracking his whip in the air, set off, and continued on the full gallop, till Saint Aubert, almost fainting, called to him to stop. Emily looked anxiously from the window, and saw a peasant walking at some little distance on the road, for whom they waited, till he came up, when he was asked, if there was any house in the neighborhood that accommodated travelers. He replied, that he knew of none. There is a chateau, indeed, among those woods on the right, added he, but I believe it receives nobody, and I cannot show you the way, for I am almost a stranger here. Saint Aubert was going to ask him some further question concerning the chateau, but the man abruptly passed on. After some consideration, he ordered Michael to proceed slowly to the woods. Every moment now deepened the twilight, and increased the difficulty of finding the road. Another peasant soon after passed. "Which is the way to the chateau in the woods?" cried Michael. "The chateau in the woods!" exclaimed the peasant. "Do you mean that with the turret, yonder?"
"I don't know as for the turret, as you call it," said Michael. "I mean that white piece of a building, that we see at a distance there, among the trees."
"Yes, that is the turret. Why, who are you, that you are going thither?" said the man with surprise. Saint Aubert, on hearing this odd question, and observing the peculiar tone in which it was delivered, looked out from the carriage.
"We are travelers," said he, "who are in search of a house of accommodation for the night. Is there any hereabout?"
"None, monsieur, unless you have a mind to try your luck yonder," replied the peasant, pointing to the woods, "but I would not advise you to go there."
"To whom does the chateau belong?"
"I scarcely know myself, monsieur."
"It is uninhabited, then?"
"No, not uninhabited, the steward and housekeeper are there, I believe."
On hearing this, Saint Aubert determined to proceed to the chateau, and risk the refusal of being accommodated for the night. He therefore desired the countryman would show Michael the way, and bade him expect reward for his trouble. The man was for a moment silent, and then said, that he was going on other business, but that the road could not be missed, if they went up an avenue to the right, to which he pointed. Saint Aubert was going to speak, but the peasant wished him good night, and walked on. The carriage now moved towards the avenue, which was guarded by a gate, and Michael having dismounted to open it, they entered between rows of ancient oak and chestnut, whose intermingled branches formed a lofty arch above. There was something so gloomy and desolate in the appearance of this avenue, and its lonely silence, that Emily almost shuddered as she passed along, and, recollecting the manner in which the peasant had mentioned the chateau, she gave a mysterious meaning to his words, such as she had not suspected when he uttered them. These apprehensions, however, she tried to check, considering that they were probably the effect of a melancholy imagination, which her father's situation, and a consideration of her own circumstances, had made sensible to every impression. They passed slowly on, for they were now almost in darkness, which, together with the unevenness of the ground, and the frequent roots of old trees, that shot up above the soil, made it necessary to proceed with caution. On a sudden Michael stopped the carriage, and, as Saint Aubert looked from the window to inquire the cause, he perceived a figure at some distance moving up the avenue. The dusk would not permit him to distinguish what it was, but he bade Michael go on.
"This seems a wild place," said Michael. "There is no house hereabout. Don't your honor think we had better turn back?"
"Go a little farther, and if we see no house then, we will return to the road," replied Saint Aubert. Michael proceeded with reluctance, and the extreme slowness of his pace made Saint Aubert look again from the window to hasten him, when again he saw the same figure. He was somewhat startled, probably the gloominess of the spot made him more liable to alarm than usual. However this might be, he now stopped Michael, and bade him call to the person in the avenue.
"Please your honor, he may be a robber," said Michael.
"It does not please me," replied Saint Aubert, who could not forbear smiling at the simplicity of his phrase, "and we will, therefore, return to the road, for I see no probability of meeting here with what we seek." Michael turned about immediately, and was retracing his way with alacrity, when a voice was heard from among the trees on the left. It was not the voice of command, or distress, but a deep hollow tone, which seemed to be scarcely human. The man whipped his mules till they went as fast as possible, regardless of the darkness, the broken ground, and the necks of the whole party, nor once stopped till he reached the gate, which opened from the avenue into the high road, where he went into a more moderate pace.
"I am very ill," said Saint Aubert, taking his daughter's hand.
"You are worse, then, sir," said Emily, extremely alarmed by his manner. "You are worse, and here is no assistance.
Good God! What is to be done?"
He leaned his head on her shoulder, while she endeavored to support him with her arm, and Michael was again ordered to stop. When the rattling of the wheels had ceased, music was heard on their air. It was to Emily the voice of hope.
"Oh! We are near some human habitation," said she, "help may soon be had."
She listened anxiously. The sounds were distant, and seemed to come from a remote part of the woods that bordered the road, and, as she looked towards the spot whence they issued, she perceived in the faint moonlight something like a chateau. It was difficult, however, to reach this. Saint Aubert was now too ill to bear the motion of the carriage. Michael could not quit his mules, and Emily, who still supported her father, feared to leave him, and also feared to venture alone to such a distance, she knew not whither, or to whom. Something, however, it was necessary to determine upon immediately. Saint Aubert, therefore, told Michael to proceed slowly, but they had not gone far, when he fainted, and the carriage was again stopped. He lay quite senseless. "My dear,
"Dear father," cried Emily in great agony, who began to fear that he was dying, "speak, if it is only one word, to let me hear the sound of your voice." But no voice spoke in reply. In the agony of terror, she bade Michael bring water from the rivulet that flowed along the road, and, having received some in the man's hat, with trembling hands she sprinkled it over her father's face, which, as the moon's rays now fell upon it, seemed to bear the impression of death. Every emotion of selfish fear now gave way to a stronger influence, and, committing Street Aubert to the care of Michael, who refused to go far from his mules, she stepped from the carriage in search of the chateau she had seen at a distance. It was a still moonlight night, and the music, which yet sounded on the air, directed her steps from the high road, up a shadowy lane, that led to the woods. Her mind was for some time so entirely occupied by anxiety and terror for her father, that she felt none for herself, till the deepening gloom of the overhanging foliage, which now wholly excluded the moonlight, and the wildness of the place, recalled her to a sense of her adventurous situation. The music had ceased, and she had no guide but chance. For a moment she paused in terrified perplexity, till a sense of her father's condition again overcoming every consideration for herself, she proceeded. The lane terminated in the woods, but she looked round in vain for a house, or a human being, and as vainly listened for a sound to guide her. She hurried on, however, not knowing whither, avoiding the recesses of the woods, and endeavoring to keep along their margin, till a rude kind of avenue, which opened upon a moonlight spot, arrested her attention. The wildness of this avenue brought to her recollection the one leading to the turreted chateau, and she was inclined to believe that this was a part of the same domain, and probably led to the same point. While she hesitated whether to follow it or not, a sound of many voices in loud merriment burst upon her ear. It seemed not the laugh of cheerfulness, but of riot, and she stood appalled. While she paused, she heard a distant voice, calling from the way she had come, and not doubting but it was that of Michael, her first impulse was to hasten back, but a second thought changed her purpose. She believed that nothing less than the last extremity could have prevailed with Michael to quit his mules, and fearing that her father was now dying, she rushed forward, with a feeble hope of obtaining assistance from the people in the woods. Her heart beat with fearful expectation, as she drew near the spot whence the voices issued, and she often startled when her steps disturbed the fallen leaves. The sounds led her towards the moonlight glade she had before noticed, at a little distance from which she stopped, and saw, between the boles of the trees, a small circular level of green turf, surrounded by the woods, on which appeared a group of figures. On drawing nearer, she distinguished these, by their dress, to be peasants, and perceived several cottages scattered round the edge of the woods, which waved loftily over this spot. While she gazed, and endeavored to overcome the apprehensions that withheld her steps, several peasant girls came out of a cottage, music instantly struck up, and the dance began. It was the joyous music of the vintage, the same she had before heard upon the air. Her heart, occupied with terror for her father, could not feel the contrast which this gay scene offered to her own distress. She stepped hastily forward towards a group of elder peasants, who were seated at the door of a cottage, and, having explained her situation, entreated their assistance. Several of them rose with alacrity, and, offering any service in their power, followed Emily, who seemed to move on the wind, as fast as they could towards the road. When she reached the carriage she found Saint Aubert restored to animation. On the recovery of his senses, having heard from Michael whither his daughter was gone, anxiety for her overcame every regard for himself, and he had sent him in search of her. He was, however, still languid, and, perceiving himself unable to travel much farther, he renewed his inquiries for an inn, and concerning the chateau in the woods. "The chateau cannot accommodate you, sir," said a venerable peasant who had followed Emily from the woods, "it is scarcely inhabited, but, if you will do me the honor to visit my cottage, you shall be welcome to the best bed it affords." Saint Aubert was himself a Frenchman, he therefore was not surprised at French courtesy, but, ill as he was, he felt the value of the offer enhanced by the manner which accompanied it. He had too much delicacy to apologize, or to appear to hesitate about availing himself of the peasant's hospitality, but immediately accepted it with the same frankness with which it was offered. The carriage again moved slowly on, Michael following the peasants up the lane, which Emily had just quitted, till they came to the moonlight glade. Saint Aubert's spirits were so far restored by the courtesy of his host, and the near prospect of repose, that he looked with a sweet complacency upon the moonlight scene, surrounded by the shadowy woods, through which, here and there, an opening admitted the streaming splendor, discovering a cottage, or a sparkling rivulet. He listened, with no painful emotion, to the merry notes of the guitar and tambourine, and, though tears came to his eyes, when he saw the debonair dance of the peasants, they were not merely tears of mournful regret. With Emily it was otherwise. Immediate terror for her father had now subsided into a gentle melancholy, which every note of joy, by awakening comparison, served to heighten. The dance ceased on the approach of the carriage, which was a phenomenon in these sequestered woods, and the peasantry flocked round it with eager curiosity. On learning that it brought a sick stranger, several girls ran across the turf, and returned with wine and baskets of grapes, which they presented to the travelers, each with kind contention pressing for a preference. At length, the carriage stopped at a neat cottage, and his venerable conductor, having assisted Street Aubert to alight, led him and Emily to a small inner room, illuminated only by moonbeams, which the open casement admitted. Saint Aubert, rejoicing in rest, seated himself in an armchair, and his senses were refreshed by the cool and balmy air, that lightly waved the embowering honeysuckles, and wafted their sweet breath into the apartment. His host, who was called La Voisin, quitted the room, but soon returned with fruits, cream, and all the pastoral luxury his cottage afforded, having set down which, with a smile of unfeigned welcome, he retired behind the chair of his guest. Saint Aubert insisted on his taking a seat at the table, and, when the fruit had allayed the fever of his palate, and he found himself somewhat revived, he began to converse with his host, who communicated several particulars concerning himself and his family, which were interesting, because they were spoken from the heart, and delineated a picture of the sweet courtesies of family kindness. Emily sat by her father, holding his hand, and, while she listened to the old man, her heart swelled with the affectionate sympathy he described, and her tears fell to the mournful consideration, that death would probably soon deprive her of the dearest blessing she then possessed. The soft moonlight of an autumnal evening, and the distant music, which now sounded a plaintive strain, aided the melancholy of her mind. The old man continued to talk of his family, and Saint Aubert remained silent. "I have only one daughter living," said La Voisin, "but she is happily married, and is everything to me. When I lost my wife," he added with a sigh, "I came to live with Agnes, and her family. She has several children, who are all dancing on the green yonder, as merry as grasshoppers, and long may they be so. I hope to die among them, monsieur. I am old now, and cannot expect to live long, but there is some comfort in dying surrounded by one's children." "My good friend," said Saint Aubert, while his voice trembled, "I hope you will long live surrounded by them."
"Ah, sir. At my age I must not expect that," replied the old man, and he paused.
"I can scarcely wish it," he resumed, "for I trust that whenever I die I shall go to heaven, where my poor wife is gone before me. I can sometimes almost fancy I see her of a still moonlight night, walking among these shades she loves so well. Do you believe, monsieur, that we shall be permitted to revisit the earth, after we have quitted the body?" Emily could no longer stifle the anguish of her heart. Her tears fell fast upon her father's hand, which she yet held. He made an effort to speak, and at length said in a low voice, "I hope we shall be permitted to look down on those we have left on the earth, but I can only hope it. Futurity is much veiled from our eyes, and faith and hope are our only guides concerning it. We are not enjoined to believe, that disembodied spirits watch over the friends they have loved, but we may innocently hope it. It is a hope which I will never resign," continued he, while he wiped the tears from his daughter's eyes. "It will sweeten the bitter moments of death." Tears fell slowly on his cheeks, La Voisin wept too, and there was a pause of silence. Then Louisiana Voisin, renewing the subject, said, "But you believe, sir, that we shall meet in another world the relations we have loved in this?"
"I must believe this."
"Then do believe it," replied Saint Aubert. "Severe, indeed, would be the pangs of separation, if we believed it to be eternal. Look up, my dear Emily, we shall meet again." He lifted his eyes towards heaven, and a gleam of moonlight, which fell upon his countenance, discovered peace and resignation, stealing on the lines of sorrow. La Voisin felt that he had pursued the subject too far, and he dropped it, saying, "We are in darkness, I forgot to bring a light."
"No," said Saint Aubert, "this is a light I love. Sit down, my good friend. Emily, my love, I find myself better than I have been all day, this air refreshes me. I can enjoy this tranquil hour, and that music, which floats so sweetly at a distance. Let me see you smile. Who touches that guitar so tastefully? Are there two instruments, or is it an echo I hear?"
"It is an echo, monsieur, I fancy. That guitar is often heard at night, when all is still, but nobody knows who touches it, and it is sometimes accompanied by a voice so sweet, and so sad, one would almost think the woods were haunted."
"They certainly are haunted," said Saint Aubert with a smile, "but I believe it is by mortals. I have sometimes heard it at midnight, when I could not sleep, rejoined Lavoisin, not seeming to notice this remark, almost under my window, and I never heard any music like it. It has often made me think of my poor wife till I cried. I have sometimes got up to the window to look if I could see anybody, but as soon as I opened the casement all was hushed, and nobody to be seen, and I have listened, and listened till I have been so timorous, that even the trembling of the leaves and the breeze has made me start. They say it often comes to warn people of their death, but I have heard it these many years, and outlived the warning. Emily, though she smiled at the mention of this ridiculous superstition, could not, in the present tone of her spirits, wholly resist its contagion.
Well, but, my good friend, said Saint Aubert, has nobody had courage to follow the sounds?
If they had, they would probably have discovered who is the musician.
Yes, sir, they have followed them some way into the woods, but the music has still retreated, and seemed as distant as ever, and the people have at last been afraid of being led into harm, and would go no further.
It is very seldom that I have heard these sounds so early in the evening. They usually come about midnight, when that bright planet, which is rising above the turret yonder, sets below the woods on the left.
What turret?
Asked Saint Aubert with quickness. I see none.
Your pardon, monsieur, you do see one indeed, for the moon shines full upon it, up the avenue yonder, a long way off. The chateau it belongs to is hid among the trees.
Yes, my dear sir, said Emily, pointing, don't you see something glitter above the dark woods?
It is a fane, I fancy, which the rays fall upon.
Oh yes, I see what you mean, and who does the chateau belong to?
The Marquis de Villeroy was its owner, replied Lavoisin, emphatically.
Ah! Said Saint Aubert, with a deep sigh, are we then so near Leblanc? He appeared much agitated.
It used to be the Marquis's favorite residence, resumed Lavoisin, but he took a dislike to the place, and has not been there for many years. We have heard lately that he is dead, and that it has fallen into other hands.
Saint Aubert, who had sat in deep musing, was roused by the last words.
Dead! He exclaimed, good God! When did he die?
He is reported to have died about 5 weeks since, replied Lavoisin.
Did you know the Marquis, sir?
This is very extraordinary, said Saint Aubert without attending to the question.
Why is it so, my dear sir? Said Emily, in a voice of timid curiosity.
He made no reply, but sunk again into a reverie, and in a few moments, when he seemed to have recovered himself, asked who had succeeded to the estates.
I have forgot his title, monsieur, said Lavoisin, but my lord resides at Paris chiefly, I hear no talk of his coming hither.
The chateau is shut up then, still?
Why, little better, sir. The old housekeeper, and her husband the steward, have the care of it, but they live generally in a cottage hard by.
The chateau is spacious, I suppose, said Emily, and must be desolate for the residence of only two persons.
Desolate enough, mademoiselle, replied Lavoisin, I would not pass one night in the chateau, for the value of the whole domain.
What is that? Said Saint Aubert, roused again from thoughtfulness.
As his host repeated his last sentence, a groan escaped from Saint Aubert. And then, as if anxious to prevent it from being noticed, he hastily asked Lavoisin how long he had lived in this neighborhood.
Almost from my childhood, sir, replied his host.
You remember the late Marchioness, then? Said Saint Aubert in an altered voice.
Ah, monsieur. That I do well. There are many besides me who remember her.
Yes, said Saint Aubert, and I am one of those.
Alas, sir. You remember, then, a most beautiful and excellent lady. She deserved a better fate.
Tears stood in Saint Aubert's eyes.
Enough, said he, in a voice almost stifled by the violence of his emotions, it is enough, my friend.
Emily, though extremely surprised by her father's manner, forbore to express her feelings by any question.
Lavoisin began to apologize, but Saint Aubert interrupted him.
Apology is quite unnecessary, said he, let us change the topic. You were speaking of the music we just now heard.
I was, monsieur. But hark! It comes again, listen to that voice.
They were all silent.
At last a soft and solemn breathing sound rose, like a stream of rich distilled perfumes, and stole upon the air, that even silence was took ere she was ware, and wished she might deny her nature, and be never more still, to be so displaced.
Milton.
In a few moments the voice died into air, and the instrument, which had been heard before, sounded in low symphony. Saint Aubert now observed that it produced a tone much more full and melodious than that of a guitar, and still more melancholy and soft than the lute. They continued to listen, but the sounds returned no more.
This is strange, said Saint Aubert, at length interrupting the silence.
Very strange, said Emily. It is so, rejoined La Voisin, and they were again silent.
After a long pause, it is now about 18 years since I first heard that music, said La Voisin. I remember it was on a fine summer's night, much like this, but later, that I was walking in the woods, and alone. I remember, too, that my spirits were very low, for one of my boys was ill, and we feared we should lose him. I had been watching at his bedside all the evening while his mother slept, for she had sat up with him the night before. I had been watching, and went out for a little fresh air. The day had been very sultry. As I walked under the shades and mused, I heard music at a distance, and thought it was Claude playing upon his flute, as he often did of a fine evening, at the cottage door. But, when I came to a place where the trees opened, I shall never forget it, and stood looking up at the north lights, which shot up the heaven to a great height, I heard all of a sudden such sounds. They came so as I cannot describe. It was like the music of angels, and I looked up again almost expecting to see them in the sky. When I came home, I told what I had heard, but they laughed at me, and said it must be some of the shepherds playing on their pipes, and I could not persuade them to the contrary. A few nights after, however, my wife herself heard the same sounds, and was as much surprised as I was, and Father Dennis frightened her sadly by saying, that it was music come to warn her of her child's death, and that music often came to houses where there was a dying person. Emily, on hearing this, shrunk with a superstitious dread entirely new to her, and could scarcely conceal her agitation from Saint Aubert. But the boy lived, monsieur, in spite of Father Dennis.
Father Dennis, said Saint Aubert, who had listened to narrative old age with patient attention, are we near a convent, then?
Yes, sir, the convent of St. Clair stands at no great distance, on the seashore yonder.
Ah, said St. Aubert, as if struck with some sudden remembrance, the convent of St. Clair.
Emily observed the clouds of grief, mingled with a faint expression of horror, gathering on his brow. His countenance became fixed, and, touched as it now was by the silver whiteness of the moonlight, he resembled one of those marble statues of a monument, which seemed to bend, in hopeless sorrow, over the ashes of the dead, shone by the blunted light that the dim moon threw painted casements lens. The emigrants.
But, my dear sir, said Emily, anxious to dissipate his thoughts, you forget that repose is necessary to you. If our kind host will give me leave, I will prepare your bed, for I know how you like it to be made.
Saint Aubert, recollecting himself, and smiling affectionately, desired she would not add to her fatigue by that attention, and La Voisin, whose consideration for his guest had been suspended by the interests which his own narrative had recalled, now started from his seat, and, apologizing for not having called Agnes from the green, hurried out of the room. In a few moments he returned with his daughter, a young woman of pleasing countenance, and Emily learned from her, what she had not before suspected, that, for their accommodation, it was necessary part of La Voisin's family should leave their beds. She lamented this circumstance, but Agnes, by her reply, fully proved that she inherited, at least, a share of her father's courteous hospitality. It was settled, that some of her children and Michael should sleep in the neighboring cottage.
If I am better, tomorrow, my dear, said Saint Aubert when Emily returned to him, I mean to set out at an early hour, that we may rest, during the heat of the day, and will travel towards home. In the present state of my health and spirits I cannot look on a longer journey with pleasure, and I am also very anxious to reach La Vallée.
Emily, though she also desired to return, was grieved at her father's sudden wish to do so, which she thought indicated a greater degree of indisposition than he would acknowledge. Saint Aubert now retired to rest, and Emily to her little chamber, but not to immediate repose. Her thoughts returned to the late conversation, concerning the state of departed spirits, a subject, at this time, particularly affecting to her, when she had every reason to believe that her dear father would ere long be numbered with them. She leaned pensively on the little open casement, and in deep thought fixed her eyes on the heaven, whose blue unclouded concave was studded thick with stars, the worlds, perhaps, of spirits, unsphered of mortal mould. As her eyes wandered along the boundless ether, her thoughts rose, as before, towards the sublimity of the deity, and to the contemplation of futurity. No busy note of this world interrupted the course of her mind. The merry dance had ceased, and every cottager had retired to his home. The still air seemed scarcely to breathe upon the woods, and, now and then, the distant sound of a solitary sheep bell, or of a closing casement, was all that broke on silence. At length, even this hint of human being was heard no more. Elevated and enrapt, while her eyes were often wet with tears of sublime devotion and solemn awe, she continued at the casement, till the gloom of midnight hung over the earth, and the planet, which Lavoisin had pointed out, sunk below the woods. She then recollected what he had said concerning this planet, and the mysterious music, and, as she lingered at the window, half hoping and half fearing that it would return, her mind was led to the remembrance of the extreme emotion her father had shown on mention of the Marquis Lavoisin's death, and of the fate of the Marchioness, and she felt strongly interested concerning the remote cause of this emotion. Her surprise and curiosity were indeed the greater, because she did not recollect ever to have heard him mention the name of Villeroy. No music, however, stole on the silence of the night, and Emily, perceiving the lateness of the hour, returned to a scene of fatigue, remembered that she was to rise early in the morning, and withdrew from the window to repose. Chapter 7. Let those deplore their doom, whose hope still grovels in this dark sojourn. But lofty souls can look beyond the tomb, can smile at fate, and wonder how they mourn. Shall spring to these sad scenes no more return? Is yonder wave the sun's eternal bed? Soon shall the orient with new luster burn, and spring shall soon her vital influence shed, again attune the grove, again adorn the mead. Beatty. Emily, called, as she had requested, at an early hour, awoke, little refreshed by sleep, for uneasy dreams had pursued her, and marred the kindest blessing of the unhappy. But, when she opened her casement, looked out upon the woods, bright with the morning sun, and inspired the pure air, her mind was soothed. The scene was filled with that cheering freshness, which seems to breathe the very spirit of health, and she heard only sweet and underscore picturesque underscore sounds, if such an expression may be allowed, the matine bell of a distant convent, the faint murmur of the sea waves, the song of birds, and the far-off low of cattle, which she saw coming slowly on between the trunks of trees. Struck with the circumstances of imagery around her, she indulged the pensive tranquility which they inspired, and while she leaned on her window, waiting till St. Aubert should descend to breakfast, her ideas arranged themselves in the following lines. The first hour of morning. How sweet to wind the forest's tangled shade, when early twilight, from the eastern bound, dawns on the sleeping landscape in the glade, and fades as morning spreads her blush around. When every infant flower, that wept at night, lifts its chill head soft glowing with a tear, expands its tender blossom to the light, and gives its incense to the genial air. How fresh the breeze that wafts the rich perfume, and swells the melody of waking birds, the hum of bees, beneath the verdant gloom, and woodman's song, and low of distant herds. Then, doubtful gleams the mountain's hoary head, seen through the parting foliage from afar, and, farther still, the ocean's misty bed, with flitting sails, that partial sunbeams share. But, vain the sylvan shade, the breath of May, the voice of music floating on the gale, and forms, that beam through morning's dewy veil, if health no longer bid the heart be gay. O balmy hour! 'Tis thine her wealth to give, here spread her blush, and bid the parent live. Emily now heard persons moving below in the cottage, and presently the voice of Michael, who was talking to his mules, as he led them forth from a hut adjoining. As she left her room, St. Aubert, who was now risen, met her at the door, apparently as little restored by sleep as herself. She led him downstairs to the little parlor, in which they had supped on the preceding night, where they found a neat breakfast set out, while the host and his daughter waited to bid them good morrow. I envy you this cottage, my good friends, said St. Aubert, as he met them. It is so pleasant, so quiet, and so neat, and this air, that one breathes. If anything could restore lost health, it would surely be this air. Lavoisin bowed gratefully, and replied, with the gallantry of a Frenchman, our cottage may be envied, sir, since you and Mademoiselle have honored it with your presence. St. Aubert gave him a friendly smile for his compliment, and sat down to a table, spread with cream, fruit, new cheese, butter, and coffee. Emily, who had observed her father with attention and thought he looked very ill, endeavored to persuade him to defer traveling till the afternoon, but he seemed very anxious to be at home, and his anxiety he expressed repeatedly, and with an earnestness that was unusual with him. He now said, he found himself as well as he had been of late, and that he could bear traveling better in the cool hour of the morning, than at any other time. But, while he was talking with his venerable host, and thanking him for his kind attentions, Emily observed his countenance change, and, before she could reach him, he fell back in his chair. In a few moments he recovered from the sudden faintness that had come over him, but felt so ill, that he perceived himself unable to set out, and, having remained a little while, struggling against the pressure of indisposition, he begged he might be helped upstairs to bed. This request renewed all the terror which Emily had suffered on the preceding evening, but, though scarcely able to support herself, under the sudden shock it gave her, she tried to conceal her apprehensions from St. Aubert, and gave her trembling arm to assist him to the door of his chamber. When he was once more in bed, he desired that Emily, who was then weeping in her own room, might be called, and, as she came, he waved his hand for every other person to quit the apartment. When they were alone, he held out his hand to her, and fixed his eyes upon her countenance, with an expression so full of tenderness and grief, that all her fortitude forsook her, and she burst into an agony of tears. Saint Aubert seemed struggling to acquire firmness, but was still unable to speak. He could only press her hand, and check the tears that stood trembling in his eyes. At length he commanded his voice, "My dear child," said he, trying to smile through his anguish, "my dear Emily," and paused again. He raised his eyes to heaven, as if in prayer, and then, in a firmer tone, and with a look, in which the tenderness of the father was dignified by the pious solemnity of the saint, he said, "My dear child, I would soften the painful truth I have to tell you, but I find myself quite unequal to the art. Alas! I would, at this moment, conceal it from you, but that it would be most cruel to deceive you. It cannot be long before we must part. Let us talk of it, that our thoughts and our prayers may prepare us to bear it." His voice faltered, while Emily, still weeping, pressed his hand close to her heart, which swelled with a convulsive sigh, but she could not look up. "Let me not waste these moments," said Saint Aubert, recovering himself. "I have much to say. There is a circumstance of solemn consequence, which I have to mention, and a solemn promise to obtain from you. When this is done I shall be easier. You have observed, my dear, how anxious I am to reach home, but know not all my reasons for this. Listen to what I am going to say. Yet stay, before I say more, give me this promise, a promise made to your dying father." Saint Aubert was interrupted. Emily, struck by his last words, as if for the first time, with a conviction of his immediate danger, raised her head, her tears stopped, and, gazing at him for a moment with an expression of unutterable anguish, a slight convulsion seized her, and she sunk senseless in her chair. Saint Aubert's cries brought Lavoisin and his daughter to the room, and they administered every means in their power to restore her, but, for a considerable time, without effect. When she recovered, Saint Aubert was so exhausted by the scene he had witnessed, that it was many minutes before he had strength to speak. He was, however, somewhat revived by a cordial, which Emily gave him, and, being again alone with her, he exerted himself to tranquilize her spirits, and to offer her all the comfort of which her situation admitted. She threw herself into his arms, wept on his neck, and grief made her so insensible to all he said, that he ceased to offer the alleviations, which he himself could not, at this moment, feel, and mingled his silent tears with hers. Recalled, at length, to a sense of duty, she tried to spare her father from a farther view of her suffering, and, quitting his embrace, dried her tears, and said something, which she meant for consolation. "My dear Emily," replied Saint Aubert, "my dear child, we must look up with humble confidence to that being, who has protected and comforted us in every danger, and in every affliction we have known, to whose eye every moment of our lives has been exposed. He will not, he does not, forsake us now. I feel his consolations in my heart. I shall leave you, my child, still in his care, and, though I depart from this world, I shall be still in his presence. Nay, weep not again, my Emily. In death there is nothing new, or surprising, since we all know, that we are born to die, and nothing terrible to those, who can confide in an all-powerful God. Had my life been spared now, after a very few years, in the course of nature, I must have resigned it. Old age, with all its train of infirmity, its privations and its sorrows, would have been mine, and then, at last, death would have come, and called forth the tears you now shed. Rather, my child, rejoice, that I am saved from such suffering, and that I am permitted to die with a mind unimpaired, and sensible of the comforts of faith and resignation." Saint Aubert paused, fatigued with speaking. Emily again endeavored to assume an air of composure, and, in replying to what he had said, tried to soothe him with a belief, that he had not spoken in vain. When he had reposed a while, he resumed the conversation. "Let me return," said he, "to a subject, which is very near my heart. I said I had a solemn promise to receive from you. Let me receive it now. Before I explain the chief circumstance which it concerns, there are others, of which your peace requires that you should rest in ignorance. Promise, then, that you will perform exactly what I shall enjoin." Emily, awed by the earnest solemnity of his manner, dried her tears, that had begun again to flow, in spite of her efforts to suppress them, and, looking eloquently at Saint Aubert, bound herself to do whatever he should require by a vow, at which she shuddered, yet knew not why. He proceeded, "I know you too well, my Emily, to believe, that you would break any promise, much less one thus solemnly given. Your assurance gives me peace, and the observance of it is of the utmost importance to your tranquility. Hear, then, what I am going to tell you. The closet, which adjoins my chamber at Lavelay, has a sliding board in the floor. You will know it by a remarkable knot in the wood, and by its being the next board, except one, to the wainscot, which fronts the door. At the distance of about a yard from that end, nearer the window, you will perceive a line across it, as if the plank had been joined. The way to open it is this: press your foot upon the line, the end of the board will then sink, and you may slide it with ease beneath the other. Below, you will see a hollow place. Saint Aubert paused for breath, and Emily sat fixed in deep attention. "Do you understand these directions, my dear?" said he. Emily, though scarcely able to speak, assured him that she did. "When you return home, then," he added with a deep sigh. At the mention of her return home, all the melancholy circumstances that must attend this return rushed upon her fancy. She burst into convulsive grief, and Saint Aubert himself, affected beyond the resistance of the fortitude which he had, at first, summoned, wept with her. After some moments, he composed himself. "My dear child," said he, "be comforted. When I am gone, you will not be forsaken. I leave you only in the more immediate care of that Providence, which has never yet forsaken me. Do not afflict me with this excessive grief, rather teach me by your example to bear my own." He stopped again, and Emily, the more she endeavored to restrain her emotion, found it the less possible to do so. Saint Aubert, who now spoke with pain, resumed the subject. "That closet, my dear, when you return home, go to it, and, beneath the board I have described, you will find a packet of written papers. Attend to me now, for the promise you have given particularly relates to what I shall direct. These papers you must burn, and, solemnly I command you, _ without examining them _. Emily's surprise, for a moment, overcame her grief, and she ventured to ask, why this must be. Saint Aubert replied, that, if it had been right for him to explain his reasons, her late promise would have been unnecessarily exacted. "It is sufficient for you, my love, to have a deep sense of the importance of observing me in this instance," Saint Aubert proceeded. "Under that board you will also find about 200 louis d'ors, wrapped in a silk purse. Indeed, it was to secure whatever money might be in the chateau that this secret place was contrived, at a time when the province was overrun by troops of men, who took advantage of the tumults, and became plunderers. But I have yet another promise to receive from you, which is, that you will never, whatever may be your future circumstances, _sell_ the chateau." Saint Aubert even enjoined her, whenever she might marry, to make it an article in the contract, that the chateau should always be hers. He then gave her a more minute account of his present circumstances than he had yet done, adding, "The 200 louis, with what money you will now find in my purse, is all the ready money I have to leave you. I have told you how I am circumstanced with them. Metville, at Paris. Ah, my child! I leave you poor, but not destitute," he added, after a long pause. Emily could make no reply to anything he now said, but knelt at the bedside, with her face upon the quilt, weeping over the hand she held there. After this conversation, the mind of Saint Aubert appeared to be much more at ease, but, exhausted by the effort of speaking, he sunk into a kind of doze, and Emily continued to watch and weep beside him, till a gentle tap at the chamber door roused her. It was La Voisin, come to say that a confessor from the neighboring convent was below, ready to attend Saint Aubert. Emily would not suffer her father to be disturbed, but desired that the priest might not leave the cottage. When Saint Aubert awoke from this doze, his senses were confused, and it was some moments before he recovered them sufficiently to know that it was Emily who sat beside him. He then moved his lips, and stretched forth his hand to her, as she received which, she sunk back in her chair, overcome by the impression of death on his countenance. In a few minutes he recovered his voice, and Emily then asked if he wished to see the confessor. He replied that he did, and, when the Holy Father appeared, she withdrew. They remained alone together above half an hour. When Emily was called in, she found Saint Aubert more agitated than when she had left him, and she gazed, with a slight degree of resentment, at the friar, as the cause of this, who, however, looked mildly and mournfully at her, and turned away. Saint Aubert, in a tremulous voice, said he wished her to join in prayer with him, and asked if La Voisin would do so too. The old man and his daughter came, they both wept, and knelt with Emily round the bed, while the Holy Father read in a solemn voice the service for the dying. Saint Aubert lay with a serene countenance, and seemed to join fervently in the devotion, while tears often stole from beneath his closed eyelids, and Emily's sobs more than once interrupted the service. When it was concluded, and extreme unction had been administered, the friar withdrew. Saint Aubert then made a sign for Lavoisin to come nearer. He gave him his hand, and was, for a moment, silent. At length, he said, in a trembling voice, "My good friend, our acquaintance has been short, but long enough to give you an opportunity of showing me much kind attention. I cannot doubt that you will extend this kindness to my daughter. When I am gone, she will have need of it. I entrust her to your care during the few days she will remain here. I need say no more, you know the feelings of a father, for you have children. Mine would be, indeed, severe if I had less confidence in you." He paused. Lavoisin assured him, and his tears bore testimony to his sincerity, that he would do all he could to soften her affliction, and that, if Saint Aubert wished it, he would even attend her into Gascony, an offer so pleasing to Saint Aubert, that he had scarcely words to acknowledge his sense of the old man's kindness, or to tell him that he accepted it. The scene that followed between Saint Aubert and Emily affected Lavoisin so much that he quitted the chamber, and she was again left alone with her father, whose spirits seemed fading fast, but neither his senses nor his voice yet failed him, and, at intervals, he employed much of these last awful moments in advising his daughter as to her future conduct. Perhaps he never had thought more justly, or expressed himself more clearly, than he did now. "Above all, my dear Emily," said he, "do not indulge in the pride of fine feeling, the romantic error of amiable minds. Those who really possess sensibility ought early to be taught that it is a dangerous quality, which is continually extracting the excess of misery or delight from every surrounding circumstance. And since, in our passage through this world, painful circumstances occur more frequently than pleasing ones, and since our sense of evil is, I fear, more acute than our sense of good, we become the victims of our feelings, unless we can in some degree command them. I know you will say, for you were young, my Emily, I know you will say, that you are contented sometimes to suffer, rather than to give up your refined sense of happiness, at others, but, when your mind has been long harassed by vicissitude, you will be content to rest, and you will then recover from your delusion. You will perceive that the phantom of happiness is exchanged for the substance, for happiness arises in a state of peace, not of tumult. It is of a temperate and uniform nature, and can no more exist in a heart that is continually alive to minute circumstances than in one that is dead to feeling. You see, my dear, that, though I would guard you against the dangers of sensibility, I am not an advocate for apathy. At your age I should have said underscore that underscore is a vice more hateful than all the errors of sensibility, and I say so still. I call it underscore vice underscore, because it leads to positive evil. In this, however, it is no more than an ill-governed sensibility, which, by such a rule, might also be called a vice, but the evil of the former is of more general consequence. I have exhausted myself, said Saint Aubert, feebly, and have wearied you, my Emily, but, on a subject so important to your future comfort, I am anxious to be perfectly understood. Emily assured him that his advice was most precious to her, and that she would never forget it, or cease from endeavoring to profit by it. Saint Aubert smiled affectionately and sorrowfully upon her. I repeat it, said he, I would not teach you to become insensible, if I could, I would only warn you of the evils of susceptibility, and point out how you may avoid them. Beware, my love, I conjure you, of that self-delusion, which has been fatal to the peace of so many persons. Beware of priding yourself on the gracefulness of sensibility. If you yield to this vanity, your happiness is lost forever. Always remember how much more valuable is the strength of fortitude than the grace of sensibility. Do not, however, confound fortitude with apathy. Apathy cannot know the virtue. Remember, too, that one act of beneficence, one act of real usefulness, is worth all the abstract sentiment in the world. Sentiment is a disgrace, instead of an ornament, unless it lead us to good actions. The miser, who thinks himself respectable merely because he possesses wealth, and thus mistakes the means of doing good for the actual accomplishment of it, is not more blamable than the man of sentiment, without active virtue. You may have observed persons who delight so much in this sort of sensibility to sentiment, which excludes that to the calls of any practical virtue, that they turn from the distressed, and, because their sufferings are painful to be contemplated, do not endeavor to relieve them. How despicable is that humanity, which can be contented to pity, where it might assuage. Saint Aubert, some time after, spoke of Madame Cheron, his sister. Let me inform you of a circumstance that nearly affects your welfare, he added. We have, you know, had little intercourse for some years, but, As she is now your only female relation, I have thought it proper to consign you to her care, as you will see in my will, till you are of age, and to recommend you to her protection afterwards. She is not exactly the person to whom I would have committed my Emily, but I had no alternative, and I believe her to be, upon the whole, a good kind of woman. I need not recommend it to your prudence, my love, to endeavor to conciliate her kindness. You will do this for his sake, who has often wished to do so for yours." Emily assured him that whatever he requested she would religiously perform to the utmost of her ability. "Alas," added she, in a voice interrupted by sighs, "that will soon be all which remains for me. It will be almost my only consolation to fulfill your wishes." Saint Aubert looked up silently in her face, as if would have spoken, but his spirit sunk awhile, and his eyes became heavy and dull. She felt that look at her heart. "My dear father," she exclaimed, and then, checking herself, pressed his hand closer, and hid her face with her handkerchief. Her tears were concealed, but Saint Aubert heard her convulsive sobs. His spirits returned. "Oh, my child," said he, faintly, "let my consolations be yours. I die in peace, for I know that I am about to return to the bosom of my father, who will still be your father when I am gone. Always trust in him, my love, and he will support you in these moments, as he supports me." Emily could only listen and weep, but the extreme composure of his manner, and the faith and hope he expressed, somewhat soothed her anguish. Yet, whenever she looked upon his emaciated countenance, and saw the lines of death beginning to prevail over it, saw his sunk eyes, still bent on her, and their heavy lids pressing to a close, there was a pang in her heart, such as defied expression, though it required filial virtue, like hers, to forbear the attempt. He desired once more to bless her. "Where are you, my dear?" said he, as he stretched forth his hands. Emily had turned to the window, that he might not perceive her anguish. She now understood that his sight had failed him. When he had given her his blessing, and it seemed to be the last effort of expiring life, he sunk back on his pillow. She kissed his forehead. The damps of death had settled there, and, forgetting her fortitude for a moment, her tears mingled with them. Saint Aubert lifted up his eyes, the spirit of a father returned to them, but it quickly vanished, and he spoke no more. Saint Aubert lingered till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and, thus gradually sinking into death, he expired without a struggle or a sigh. Emily was led from the chamber by La Voisin and his daughter, who did what they could to comfort her. The old man sat and wept with her. Agnes was more erroneously officious. Chapter 8. O'er him, whose doom thy virtues grieve, aerial forms shall sit at eve, and bend the pensive head. Collins. The monk, who had before appeared, returned in the evening to offer consolation to Emily, and brought a kind message from the lady abbess, inviting her to the convent. Emily, though she did not accept the offer, returned an answer expressive of her gratitude. The holy conversation of the friar, whose mild benevolence of manners bore some resemblance to those of Saint Aubert, soothed the violence of her grief, and lifted her heart to the being who, extending through all place and all eternity, looks on the events of this little world as on the shadows of a moment, and beholds equally, and in the same instant, the soul that has passed the gates of death, and that which still lingers in the body. "In the sight of God," said Emily, "my dear father now exists, as truly as he yesterday existed to me. It is to me only that he is dead; to God and to himself he yet lives." The good monk left her more tranquil than she had been since Saint Aubert died, and, before she retired to her little cabin for the night, she trusted herself so far as to visit the corpse. Silent, and without weeping, she stood by its side. The features, placid and serene, told the nature of the last sensations that had lingered in the now deserted frame. For a moment she turned away, in horror of the stillness in which death had fixed that countenance, never till now seen otherwise than animated, then gazed on it with a mixture of doubt and awful astonishment. Her reason could scarcely overcome an involuntary and unaccountable expectation of seeing that beloved countenance still susceptible. She continued to gaze wildly, took up the cold hand, spoke, still gazed, and then burst into a transport of grief. La Voisin, hearing her sobs, came into the room to lead her away, but she heard nothing, and only begged that he would leave her. Again alone, she indulged her tears, and, when the gloom of evening obscured the chamber, and almost veiled from her eyes the object of her distress, she still hung over the body, till her spirits, at length, were exhausted, and she became tranquil. La Voisin again knocked at the door, and entreated that she would come to the common apartment. Before she went, she kissed the lips of Saint Aubert, as she was wont to do when she bade him good night. Again she kissed them, her heart felt as if it would break, a few tears of agony started to her eyes, she looked up to heaven, then at St. Aubert, and left the room. Retired to her lonely cabin, her melancholy thoughts still hovered round the body of her deceased parent, and, when she sunk into a kind of slumber, the images of her waking mind still haunted her fancy. She thought she saw her father approaching her with a benign countenance, then, smiling mournfully and pointing upwards, his lips moved, but, instead of words, she heard sweet music borne on the distant air, and presently saw his features glow with the mild rapture of a superior being. The strain seemed to swell louder, and she awoke. The vision was gone, but music yet came to her ear in strains such as angels might breathe. She doubted, listened, raised herself in the bed, and again listened. It was music, and not an illusion of her imagination. After a solemn steady harmony, it paused, then rose again, in mournful sweetness, and then died, in a cadence that seemed to bear away the listening soul to heaven. She instantly remembered the music of the preceding night, with the strange circumstances, related by La Voisin, and the affecting conversation it had led to, concerning the state of departed spirits. All that St. Aubert had said, on that subject, now pressed upon her heart, and overwhelmed it. What a change in a few hours! He, who then could only conjecture, was now made acquainted with truth, was himself become one of the departed. As she listened, she was chilled with superstitious awe, her tears stopped, and she rose, and went to the window. All without was obscured in shade, but Emily, turning her eyes from the massy darkness of the woods, whose waving outline appeared on the horizon, saw, on the left, that effulgent planet, which the old man had pointed out, setting over the woods. She remembered what he had said concerning it, and, the music now coming at intervals on the air, she unclosed the casement to listen to the strains, that soon gradually sunk to a greater distance, and tried to discover whence they came. The obscurity prevented her from distinguishing any object on the green platform below, and the sounds became fainter and fainter, till they softened into silence. She listened, but they returned no more. Soon after, she observed the planet trembling between the fringed tops of the woods, and, in the next moment, sink behind them. Chilled with a melancholy awe, she retired once more to her bed, and, at length, forgot for a while her sorrows in sleep. On the following morning, she was visited by a sister of the convent, who came, with kind offices and a second invitation from the lady abbess, and Emily, though she could not forsake the cottage, while the remains of her father were in it, consented, however painful such a visit must be, in the present state of her spirits, to pay her respects to the abbess, in the evening. About an hour before sunset, La Voisin showed her the way through the woods to the convent, which stood in a small bay of the Mediterranean, crowned by a woody amphitheatre, and Emily, had she been less unhappy, would have admired the extensive sea view, that appeared from the green slope, in front of the edifice, and the rich shores, hung with woods and pastures, that extended on either hand. But her thoughts were now occupied by one sad idea, and the features of nature were to her colorless and without form. The bell for vespers struck, as she passed the ancient gate of the convent, and seemed the funereal note for St. Aubert. Little incidents affect a mind, enervated by sorrow. Emily struggled against the sickening faintness that came over her, and was led into the presence of the abbess, who received her with an air of maternal tenderness, an air of such gentle solicitude and consideration, as touched her with an instantaneous gratitude. Her eyes were filled with tears, and the words she would have spoken faltered on her lips. The abbess led her to a seat, and sat down beside her, still holding her hand and regarding her in silence, as Emily dried her tears and attempted to speak. "Be composed, my daughter," said the abbess in a soothing voice, "do not speak yet, I know all you would say. Your spirits must be soothed. We are going to prayers, will you attend our evening service? It is comfortable, my child, to look up in our afflictions to a Father, who sees and pities us, and who chastens in his mercy." Emily's tears flowed again, but a thousand sweet emotions mingled with them. The abbess suffered her to weep without interruption, and watched over her with a look of benignity, that might have characterized the countenance of a guardian angel. Emily, when she became tranquil, was encouraged to speak without reserve, and to mention the motive that made her unwilling to quit the cottage, which the abbess did not oppose even by a hint, but praised the filial piety of her conduct, and added a hope that she would pass a few days at the convent before she returned to La Vallée. "You must allow yourself a little time to recover from your first shock, my daughter, before you encounter a second. I will not affect to conceal from you how much I know your heart must suffer on returning to the scene of your former happiness. Here, you will have all that quiet and sympathy and religion can give to restore your spirits. But come," added she, observing the tears swell in Emily's eyes, "we will go to the chapel." Emily followed to the parlor, where the nuns were assembled, to whom the abbess committed her, saying, "This is a daughter, for whom I have much esteem, be sisters to her." They passed on in a train to the chapel, where the solemn devotion, with which the service was performed, elevated her mind, and brought to it the comforts of faith and resignation. Twilight came on, before the abbess's kindness would suffer Emily to depart, when she left the convent, with a heart much lighter than she had entered it, and was reconducted by La Voisin through the woods, the pensive gloom of which was in unison with the temper of her mind, and she pursued a little wild path, in musing silence, till her guide suddenly stopped, looked round, and then struck out of the path into the high grass, saying he had mistaken the road. He now walked on quickly, and Emily, proceeding with difficulty over the obscured and uneven ground, was left at some distance, till her voice arrested him, who seemed unwilling to stop, and still hurried on. "If you are in doubt about the way," said Emily, "had we not better inquire it at the chateau yonder, between the trees?" "No," replied La Voisin, "there is no occasion. When we reach that brook, mademoiselle, you see the light upon the water there, beyond the woods, when we reach that brook, we shall be at home presently. I don't know how I happen to mistake the path, I seldom come this way after sunset." "It is solitary enough," said Emily, "but you have no banditti here."
"No, mademoiselle, no banditti."
"What are you afraid of then, my good friend? You are not superstitious?"
"No, not superstitious, but, to tell you the truth, lady, nobody likes to go near that chateau, after dusk."
"By whom is it inhabited," said Emily, "that it is so formidable?"
"Why, mademoiselle, it is scarcely inhabited, for our lord the marquis, and the lord of all these fine woods, too, is dead. He had not once been in it, for these many years, and his people, who have the care of it, live in a cottage close by."
Emily now understood this to be the chateau, which La Voisin had formerly pointed out, as having belonged to the Marquis Villeroy, on the mention of which her father had appeared so much affected.
"Ah! It is a desolate place now," continued La Voisin, "and such a grand, fine place, as I remember it."
Emily inquired what had occasioned this lamentable change, but the old man was silent, and Emily, whose interest was awakened by the fear he had expressed, and above all by a recollection of her father's agitation, repeated the question, and added, "If you are neither afraid of the inhabitants, my good friend, nor are superstitious, how happens it, that you dread to pass near that chateau in the dark?"
"Perhaps, then, I am a little superstitious, mademoiselle, and, if you knew what I do, you might be so too. Strange things have happened there. Monsieur, your good father, appeared to have known the late marchioness.
Pray inform me what did happen?" said Emily, with much emotion.
"Alas! Mademoiselle," answered La Voisin, "inquire no further, it is not for me to lay open the domestic secrets of my lord."
Emily, surprised by the old man's words, and his manner of delivering them, forbore to repeat her question. A nearer interest, the remembrance of Saint Aubert, occupied her thoughts, and she was led to recollect the music she heard on the preceding night, which she mentioned to La Voisin.
"You were not alone, mademoiselle, in this," he replied. "I heard it too, but I have so often heard it, at the same hour, that I was scarcely surprised."
"You doubtless believe this music to have some connection with the chateau," said Emily suddenly, "and are, therefore, superstitious."
"It may be so, mademoiselle, but there are other circumstances, belonging to that chateau, which I remember, and sadly too."
A heavy sigh followed, but Emily's delicacy restrained the curiosity these words revived, and she inquired no further. On reaching the cottage, all the violence of her grief returned. It seemed as if she had escaped its heavy pressure only while she was removed from the object of it. She passed immediately to the chamber, where the remains of her father were laid, and yielded to all the anguish of hopeless grief. La Voisin, at length, persuaded her to leave the room, and she returned to her own, where, exhausted by the sufferings of the day, she soon fell into deep sleep, and awoke considerably refreshed. When the dreadful hour arrived, in which the remains of Saint Aubert were to be taken from her forever, she went alone to the chamber to look upon his countenance yet once again, and La Voisin, who had waited patiently below stairs, till her despair should subside, with the respect due to grief, forbore to interrupt the indulgence of it, till surprise, at the length of her stay, and then apprehension overcame his delicacy, and he went to lead her from the chamber. Having tapped gently at the door, without receiving an answer, he listened attentively, but all was still, no sigh, no sob of anguish was heard. Yet more alarmed by this silence, he opened the door, and found Emily lying senseless across the foot of the bed, near which stood a coffin. His calls procured assistance, and she was carried to her room,
were proper applications, at length, restored her. During her state of insensibility, Lavoisin had given directions for the coffin to be closed, and he succeeded in persuading Emily to forbear revisiting the chamber. She, indeed, felt herself unequal to this, and also perceived the necessity of sparing her spirits, and recollecting fortitude sufficient to bear her through the approaching scene. Saint Aubert had given a particular injunction, that his remains should be interred in the church of the convent of Saint Clair, and, in mentioning the north chancel, near the ancient tomb of the Villerois, had pointed out the exact spot where he wished to be laid. The superior had granted this place for the interment, and thither, therefore, the sad procession now moved, which was met, at the gates, by the venerable priest, followed by a train of friars. Every person, who heard the solemn chant of the anthem, and the peal of the organ, that struck up, when the body entered the church, and saw also the feeble steps, and the assumed tranquility of Emily, gave her involuntary tears. She shed none, but walked, her face partly shaded by a thin black veil, between two persons, who supported her, preceded by the abbess, and followed by nuns, whose plaintive voices mellowed the swelling harmony of the dirge. When the procession came to the grave the music ceased. Emily drew the veil entirely over her face, and, in a momentary pause, between the anthem and the rest of the service, her sobs were distinctly audible. The Holy Father began the service, and Emily again commanded her feelings, till the coffin was let down, and she heard the earth rattle on its lid. Then, as she shuddered, a groan burst from her heart, and she leaned for support on the person who stood next to her. In a few moments she recovered, and, when she heard those affecting and sublime words, "His body is buried in peace, and his soul returns to him that gave it," her anguish softened into tears. The abbess led her from the church into her own parlor, and there administered all the consolations that religion and gentle sympathy can give. Emily struggled against the pressure of grief, but the abbess, observing her attentively, ordered a bed to be prepared, and recommended her to retire to repose. She also kindly claimed her promise to remain a few days at the convent, and Emily, who had no wish to return to the cottage, the scene of all her sufferings, had leisure, now that no immediate care pressed upon her attention, to feel the indisposition, which disabled her from immediately traveling. Meanwhile, the maternal kindness of the abbess, and the gentle attentions of the nuns did all that was possible towards soothing her spirits and restoring her health. But the latter was too deeply wounded, through the medium of her mind, to be quickly revived. She lingered for some weeks at the convent, under the influence of a slow fever, wishing to return home, yet unable to go thither, often even reluctant to leave the spot where her father's relics were deposited, and sometimes soothing herself with the consideration that, if she died here, her remains would repose beside those of Saint Aubert. In the meanwhile, she sent letters to Madame Chiron and to the old housekeeper, informing them of a sad event that had taken place, and of her own situation. From her aunt she received an answer, abounding more in commonplace condolement than in traits of real sorrow, which assured her that a servant should be sent to conduct her to Lavallée, for that her own time was so much occupied by company that she had no leisure to undertake so long a journey. However Emily might prefer Lavallée to the old house, she could not be insensible to the indecorous and unkind conduct of her aunt, in suffering her to return thither, where she had no longer a relation to console and protect her, a conduct which was the more culpable, since Saint Aubert had appointed Madame Chiron the guardian of his orphan daughter. Madame Chiron's servant made the attendance of the good Lavoisin unnecessary, and Emily, who felt sensibly her obligations to him, for all his kind attention to her late father, as well as to herself, was glad to spare him along, and what, at his time of life, must have been a troublesome journey. During her stay at the convent, the peace and sanctity that reigned within, the tranquil beauty of the scenery without, and the delicate attentions of the abbess and the nuns, were circumstances so soothing to her mind, that they almost tempted her to leave the world, where she had lost her dearest friends, and devote herself to the cloister, in a spot, rendered sacred to her by containing the tomb of Saint Aubert. The pensive enthusiasm, too, so natural to her temper, had spread a beautiful illusion over the sanctified retirement of a nun, that almost hid from her view the selfishness of its security. But the touches, which a melancholy fancy, slightly tinctured with superstition, gave to the monastic scene, began to fade, as her spirits revived, and brought once more to her heart an image, which had only transiently been banished thence. By this she was silently awakened to hope and comfort and sweet affections, visions of happiness gleamed faintly at a distance, and, though she knew them to be illusions, she could not resolve to shut them out forever. It was the remembrance of Valancourt, of his taste, his genius, and of the countenance which glowed with both, that, perhaps, alone determined her to return to the world.
The grandeur and sublimity of the scenes, amidst which they had first met, had fascinated her fancy, and had imperceptibly contributed to render Valancourt more interesting by seeming to communicate to him somewhat of their own character. The esteem, too, which Saint Aubert had repeatedly expressed for him, sanctioned this kindness, but, though his countenance and manner had continually expressed his admiration of her, he had not otherwise declared it, and even the hope of seeing him again was so distant, that she was scarcely conscious of it, still less that it influenced her conduct on this occasion. It was several days after the arrival of Madame Chiron's servant before Emily was sufficiently recovered to undertake the journey to La Vallée. On the evening preceding her departure, she went to the cottage to take leave of La Voisin and his family, and to make them a return for their kindness. The old man she found sitting on a bench at his door, between his daughter and his son-in-law, who was just returned from his daily labor, and who was playing upon a pipe, that, in tone, resembled an oboe. A flask of wine stood beside the old man, and, before him, a small table with fruit and bread, round which stood several of his grandsons, fine rosy children, who were taking their supper, as their mother distributed it. On the edge of the little green, that spread before the cottage, were cattle and a few sheep reposing under the trees. The landscape was touched with the mellow light of the evening sun, whose long slanting beams played through a vista of the woods, and lighted up the distant turrets of the chateau. She paused a moment, before she emerged from the shade, to gaze upon the happy group before her, on the complacency and ease of healthy age, depictured on the countenance of La Voisin, the maternal tenderness of Agnes, as she looked upon her children, and the innocency of infantine pleasures, reflected in their smiles. Emily looked again at the venerable old man, and at the cottage. The memory of her father rose with full force upon her mind, and she hastily stepped forward, afraid to trust herself with a longer pause. She took an affectionate and affecting leave of La Voisin and his family. He seemed to love her as his daughter, and shed tears. Emily shed many. She avoided going into the cottage, since she knew it would revive emotions, such as she could not now endure. One painful scene yet awaited her, for she determined to visit again her father's grave, and that she might not be interrupted, or observed in the indulgence of her melancholy tenderness, she deferred her visit, till every inhabitant of the convent, except the nun who promised to bring her the key of the church, should be retired to rest. Emily remained in her chamber, till she heard the convent bell strike 12, when the nun came, as she had appointed, with the key of a private door, that opened into the church, and they descended together the narrow winding staircase, that led thither. The nun offered to accompany Emily to the grave, adding, "It is melancholy to go alone at this hour," but the former, thanking her for the consideration, could not consent to have any witness of her sorrow, and the sister, having unlocked the door, gave her the lamp. "You will remember, sister," said she, "that in the east aisle, which you must pass, is a newly opened grave. Hold the light to the ground, that you may not stumble over the loose earth." Emily, thanking her again, took the lamp, and, stepping into the church, Sister Mariette departed. But Emily paused a moment at the door. A sudden fear came over her, and she returned to the foot of the staircase, where, as she heard the steps of the nun ascending, and, while she held up the lamp, saw her black veil waving over the spiral balusters, she was tempted to call her back. While she hesitated, the veil disappeared, and, in the next moment, ashamed of her fears, she returned to the church. The cold air of the aisles chilled her, and their deep silence and extent, feebly shone upon by the moonlight, that streamed through a distant Gothic window, would at any other time have awed her into superstition. Now, grief occupied all her attention. She scarcely heard the whispering echoes of her own steps, or thought of the open grave, till she found herself almost on its brink. A friar of the convent had been buried there on the preceding evening, and, as she had sat alone in her chamber at twilight, she heard, at distance, the monks chanting the requiem for his soul. This brought freshly to her memory the circumstances of her father's death, and, as the voices, mingling with a low querulous peal of the organ, swelled faintly, gloomy and affecting visions had risen upon her mind. Now she remembered them, and, turning aside to avoid the broken ground, these recollections made her pass on with quicker steps to the grave of Saint Aubert, when in the moonlight, that fell athwart a remote part of the aisle, she thought she saw a shadow gliding between the pillars. She stopped to listen, and, not hearing any footstep, believed that her fancy had deceived her, and, no longer apprehensive of being observed, proceeded. Saint Aubert was buried beneath a plain marble, bearing little more than his name and the date of his birth and death, near the foot of the stately monument of the Valois. Emily remained at his grave, till a chime, that called the monks to early prayers, warned her to retire. Then, she wept over it a last farewell, and forced herself from the spot.
After this hour of melancholy indulgence, she was refreshed by a deeper sleep than she had experienced for a long time, and, on awakening, her mind was more tranquil and resigned than it had been since St. Aubert's death. But, when the moment of her departure from the convent arrived, all her grief returned, the memory of the dead, and the kindness of the living attached her to the place, and for the sacred spot, where her father's remains were interred, she seemed to feel all those tender affections which we conceive for home. The abbess repeated many kind assurances of regard at their parting, and pressed her to return, if ever she should find her condition elsewhere unpleasant. Many of the nuns also expressed unaffected regret at her departure, and Emily left the convent with many tears, and followed by sincere wishes for her happiness. She had traveled several leagues, before the scenes of the country, through which she passed, had power to rouse her for a moment from the deep melancholy, into which she was sunk, and, when they did, it was only to remind her, that, on her last view of them, St. Aubert was at her side, and to call up to her remembrance the remarks he had delivered on similar scenery. Thus, without any particular occurrence, passed the day in languor and dejection. She slept that night in a town on the skirts of Languedoc, and, on the following morning, entered Gascony. Towards the close of this day, Emily came within view of the plains in the neighbourhood of La Vallée, and the well-known objects of former times began to press upon her notice, and with them recollections, that awakened all her tenderness and grief. Often, while she looked through her tears upon the wild grandeur of the Pyrenees, now varied with the rich lights and shadows of evening, she remembered, that, when last she saw them, her father partook with her of the pleasure they inspired. Suddenly some scene, which he had particularly pointed out to her, would present itself, and the sick languor of despair would steal upon her heart. There! She would exclaim, there are the very cliffs, there the wood of pines, which he looked at with such delight, as we passed this road together for the last time. There, too, under the crag of that mountain, is the cottage, peeping from among the cedars, which he bade me remember, and copy with my pencil. Oh my father, shall I never see you more? As she drew near the chateau, these melancholy memorials of past times multiplied. At length, the chateau itself appeared, amid the glowing beauty of St. Aubert's favorite landscape. This was an object, which called for fortitude, not for tears. Emily dried hers, and prepared to meet with calmness the trying moment of her return to that home, where there was no longer a parent to welcome her. Yes, said she, let me not forget the lessons he has taught me. How often he has pointed out the necessity of resisting even virtuous sorrow, how often we have admired together the greatness of a mind, that can at once suffer and reason. Oh my father! If you are permitted to look down upon your child, it will please you to see, that she remembers, and endeavors to practice, the precepts you have given her. A turn on the road now allowed a nearer view of the chateau, the chimneys, tipped with light, rising from behind St. Aubert's favorite oaks, whose foliage partly concealed the lower part of the building. Emily could not suppress a heavy sigh. This, too, was his favorite tower, said she, as she gazed upon the long evening shadows, stretched athwart the landscape. How deep the repose, how lovely the scene! Lovely and tranquil as in former days. Again she resisted the pressure of sorrow, till her ear caught the gay melody of the dance, which she had so often listened to, as she walked with St. Aubert, on the margin of the Garonne, when all her fortitude forsook her, and she continued to weep, till the carriage stopped at the little gate, that opened upon what was now her own territory. She raised her eyes on the sudden stopping of the carriage, and saw her father's old housekeeper coming to open the gate. Manken also came running, and barking before her, and when his young mistress alighted, fawned, and played round her, gasping with joy. Dear Mamselle, said Teresa, and paused, and looked as if she would have offered something of condolement to Emily, whose tears now prevented reply. The dog still fawned and ran round her, and then flew towards the carriage, with a short quick bark. Ah, Mamselle! My poor master! Said Teresa, whose feelings were more awakened than her delicacy, Mencken's gone to look for him. Emily sobbed aloud, and, on looking towards the carriage, which still stood with the door open, saw the animal spring into it, and instantly leap out, and then with his nose on the ground run round the horses. Don't cry so, Mamselle, said Teresa, it breaks my heart to see you. The dog now came running to Emily, then returned to the carriage, and then back again to her, whining and discontented. Poor rogue! Said Teresa, thou hast lost thy master, thou mayst well cry. But come, my dear young lady, be comforted. What shall I get to refresh you? Emily gave her hand to the old servant, and tried to restrain her grief, while she made some kind inquiries concerning her health. But she still lingered in the walk which led to the chateau,
for within was no person to meet her with the kiss of affection, her own heart no longer palpitated with impatient joy to meet again the well-known smile, and she dreaded to see objects, which would recall the full remembrance of her former happiness. She moved slowly towards the door, paused, went on, and paused again. How silent, how forsaken, how forlorn did the chateau appear! Trembling to enter it, yet blaming herself for delaying what she could not avoid, she, at length, passed into the hall, crossed it with a hurried step, as if afraid to look round, and opened the door of that room, which she was wont to call her own. The gloom of evening gave solemnity to its silent and deserted air. The chairs, the tables, every article of furniture, so familiar to her in happier times, spoke eloquently to her heart. She seated herself, without immediately observing it, in a window, which opened upon the garden, and where Saint Aubert had often sat with her, watching the sun retire from the rich and extensive prospect that appeared beyond the groves. Having indulged her tears for some time, she became more composed, and, when Teresa, after seeing the baggage deposited in her lady's room, again appeared, she had so far recovered her spirits as to be able to converse with her. "I have made up the green bed for you, Mademoiselle," said Teresa, as she set the coffee upon the table. "I thought you would like it better than your own now, but I little thought this day month that you would come back alone. A well-a-day! The news almost broke my heart when it did come. Who would have believed that my poor master, when he went from home, would never return again?" Emily hid her face with her handkerchief and waved her hand. "Do taste the coffee," said Teresa. "My dear young lady, be comforted, we must all die. My dear master is a saint above." Emily took the handkerchief from her face and raised her eyes full of tears towards heaven. Soon after she dried them, and, in a calm, but tremulous voice, began to inquire concerning some of her late father's pensioners. "Alas a day!" said Teresa, as she poured out the coffee, and handed it to her mistress, "all that could come, have been here every day to inquire after you and my master." She then proceeded to tell, that some were dead whom they had left well, and others, who were ill, had recovered. "And see, Mademoiselle," added Teresa, "there is old Mary coming up the garden now. She has looked every day these 3 years as if she would die, yet she is alive still. She has seen the chaise at the door, and knows you are come home." The sight of this poor old woman would have been too much for Emily, and she begged Teresa would go and tell her that she was too ill to see any person that night. "Tomorrow I shall be better, perhaps, but give her this token of my remembrance." Emily sat for some time, given up to sorrow. Not an object, on which her eye glanced, but awakened some remembrance, that led immediately to the subject of her grief. Her favorite plants, which Saint Aubert had taught her to nurse, the little drawings that adorned the room, which his taste had instructed her to execute, the books that he had selected for her use, and which they had read together, her musical instruments, whose sounds he loved so well, and which he sometimes awakened himself, every object gave new force to sorrow. At length, she roused herself from this melancholy indulgence, and, summoning all her resolution, stepped forward to go into those forlorn rooms, which, though she dreaded to enter, she knew would yet more powerfully affect her, if she delayed to visit them. Having passed through the greenhouse, her courage for a moment forsook her, when she opened the door of the library, and, perhaps, the shade, which evening and the foliage of the trees near the windows threw across the room, heightened the solemnity of her feelings on entering that apartment, where everything spoke of her father. There was an armchair, in which he used to sit. She shrunk when she observed it, for she had so often seen him seated there, and the idea of him rose so distinctly to her mind, that she almost fancied she saw him before her. But she checked the illusions of a distempered imagination, though she could not subdue a certain degree of awe, which now mingled with her emotions. She walked slowly to the chair, and seated herself in it. There was a reading desk before it, on which lay a book open, as it had been left by her father. It was some moments before she recovered courage enough to examine it, and, when she looked at the open page, she immediately recollected that Saint Aubert, on the evening before his departure from the chateau, had read to her some passages from this his favorite author. The circumstance now affected her extremely. She looked at the page, wept, and looked again. To her the book appeared sacred and invaluable, and she would not have moved it, or closed the page, which he had left open, for the treasures of the Indies. Still she sat before the desk, and could not resolve to quit it, though the increasing gloom, and the profound silence of the apartment, revived a degree of painful awe. Her thoughts dwelt on the probable state of departed spirits, and she remembered the affecting conversation, which had passed between Saint Aubert and La Voisin, on the night preceding his death.
As she mused, she saw the door slowly open, and a rustling sound in a remote part of the room startled her. Through the dusk she thought she perceived something move. The subject she had been considering, and the present tone of her spirits, which made her imagination respond to every impression of her senses, gave her a sudden terror of something supernatural. She sat for a moment motionless, and then, her dissipated reason returning, "What should I fear?" said she. "If the spirits of those we love ever return to us, it is in kindness." The silence, which again reigned, made her ashamed of her late fears, and she believed that her imagination had deluded her, or that she had heard one of those unaccountable noises, which sometimes occur in old houses. The same sound, however, returned, and, distinguishing something moving towards her, and in the next instant pressed beside her into the chair, she shrieked, but her fleeting senses were instantly recalled, on perceiving that it was Mencken who sat by her, and who now I licked her hands affectionately. Perceiving her spirits unequal to the task she had assigned herself of visiting the deserted rooms of the chateau this night, when she left the library, she walked into the garden, and down to the terrace, that overhung the river. The sun was now set, but, under the dark branches of the almond trees, was seen the saffron glow of the west, spreading beyond the twilight of middle air. The bat flitted silently by, and, now and then, the morning note of the nightingale was heard. The circumstances of the hour brought to her recollection some lines, which she had once heard Saint Aubert recite on this very spot, and she had now a melancholy pleasure in repeating them. Sonnet. Now the bat circles on the breeze of eve, that creeps, in shuddering fits, along the wave, and trembles mid the woods, and through the cave whose lonely sighs the wanderer deceive. For oft, when melancholy charms his mind, he thinks the spirit of the rock he hears, nor listens, but with sweetly thrilling fears, to the low, mystic murmurs of the wind. Now the bat circles, and the twilight dew falls silent round, and, o'er the mountain cliff, the gleaming wave, and far-discovered skiff, spreads the gray veil of soft, harmonious hue. So falls her grief the dew of pity's tear dimming her lonely visions of despair. Emily, wandering on, came to St. Aubert's favorite plane tree, where so often, at this hour, they had sat beneath the shade together, and with her dear mother so often had conversed on the subject of a future state. How often, too, had her father expressed the comfort he derived from believing that they should meet in another world. Emily, overcome by these recollections, left the plane tree, and, as she leaned pensively on the wall of the terrace, she observed a group of peasants dancing gaily on the banks of the Garonne, which spread in broad expanse below, and reflected the evening light. What a contrast they formed to the desolate, unhappy Emily. They were gay and underscore debonair underscore, as they were wont to be when she, too, was gay, when St. Aubert used to listen to their merry music, with the countenance beaming pleasure and benevolence. Emily, having looked for a moment on this sprightly band, turned away, unable to bear the remembrances it excited, but where, alas, could she turn, and not meet new objects to give acuteness to grief? As she walked slowly towards the house, she was met by Teresa. "Dear Mamselle," said she, "I have been seeking you up and down this half hour, and was afraid some accident had happened to you. How can you like to wander about so in this night air? Do come into the house. Think what my poor master would have said, if he could see you. I am sure, when my dear lady died, no gentleman could take it more to heart than he did, yet you know he seldom shed a tear." "Pray, Teresa, cease," said Emily, wishing to interrupt this ill-judged, but well-meaning harangue. Teresa's loquacity, however, was not to be silenced so easily. "And when you used to grieve so," she added, "he often told you how wrong it was, for that my mistress was happy. And, if she was happy, I am sure he is so too, for the prayers of the poor, they say, reach heaven." During this speech, Emily had walked silently into the chateau, and Teresa lighted her across the hall into the common sitting parlor, where she had laid the cloth, with one solitary knife and fork, for supper. Emily was in the room before she perceived that it was not her own apartment, but she checked the emotion which inclined her to leave it, and seated herself quietly by the little supper table. Her father's hat hung upon the opposite wall. While she gazed at it, a faintness came over her. Teresa looked at her, and then at the object, on which her eyes were settled, and went to remove it, but Emily waved her hand. "No," said she, "let it remain. I am going to my chamber." "Nay, Mamselle, supper is ready." "I cannot take it," replied Emily. "I will go to my room, and try to sleep. Tomorrow I shall be better." "This is poor doings," said Teresa. "Dear lady, do take some food. I have dressed a pheasant, and a fine one it is. Old Monsieur Barros sent it this morning, for I saw him yesterday,
and told him you were coming. And I know nobody that seemed more concerned, when he heard the sad news, than he.
Did he? Said Emily, in a tender voice, while she felt her poor heart warmed for a moment by a ray of sympathy. At length, her spirits were entirely overcome, and she retired to her room.
Chapter 9. Can music's voice, can beauty's eye, can painting's glowing hand supply a charm so suited to my mind, as blows this hollow gust of wind? As drops this little weeping rill, soft tinkling down the moss-grown hill, while, through the west, where sinks the crimson day, meek twilight slowly sails, and waves her banners gray. Mason.
Emily, some time after her return to La Vallée, received letters from her aunt, Madame Chiron, in which, after some commonplace condolement and advice, she invited her to the house, and added, that, as her late brother had entrusted Emily's education to her, she should consider herself bound to overlook her conduct. Emily, at this time, wished only to remain at La Vallée, in the scenes of her early happiness, now rendered infinitely dear to her, as the late residence of those, whom she had lost forever, where she could weep unobserved, retrace their steps, and remember each minute particular of their manners. But she was equally anxious to avoid the displeasure of Madame Chiron. Though her affection would not suffer her to question, even a moment, the propriety of Saint Aubert's conduct in appointing Madame Chiron for her guardian, she was sensible that this step had made her happiness depend, in a great degree, on the humor of her aunt. In her reply, she begged permission to remain, at present, at La Vallée, mentioning the extreme dejection of her spirits, and the necessity she felt for quiet and retirement to restore them. These she knew were not to be found at Madame Chiron's, whose inclinations led her into a life of dissipation, which her ample fortune encouraged, and, having given her answer, she felt somewhat more at ease. In the first days of her affliction, she was visited by Monsieur Barros, a sincere mourner for Saint Aubert. "I may well lament my friend," said he, "for I shall never meet with his resemblance. If I could have found such a man in what is called society, I should not have left it." M. Barros's admiration of her father endeared him extremely to Emily, whose heart found almost its first relief in conversing of her parents, with a man, whom she so much revered, and who, though with such an ungracious appearance, possessed too much goodness of heart and delicacy of mind. Several weeks passed away in quiet retirement, and Emily's affliction began to soften into melancholy. She could bear to read the books she had before read with her father, to sit in his chair in the library, to watch the flowers his hand had planted, to awaken the tones of that instrument his fingers had pressed, and sometimes even to play his favorite air. When her mind had recovered from the first shock of affliction, perceiving the danger of yielding to indolence, and that activity alone could restore its tone, she scrupulously endeavored to pass all her hours in employment. And it was now that she understood the full value of the education she had received from Saint Aubert, for in cultivating her understanding he had secured her an asylum from indolence, without recourse to dissipation, and rich and varied amusement and information, independent of the society, from which her situation secluded her. Nor were the good effects of this education confined to selfish advantages, since, Saint Aubert having nourished every amiable quality of her heart, it now expanded in benevolence to all around her, and taught her, when she could not remove the misfortunes of others, at least to soften them by sympathy and tenderness, a benevolence that taught her to feel for all that could suffer. Madame Chiron returned no answer to Emily's letter, who began to hope that she should be permitted to remain some time longer in her retirement, and her mind had now so far recovered its strength that she ventured to view the scenes which most powerfully recalled the images of past times. Among these was the fishing house, and, to indulge still more the affectionate melancholy of the visit, she took thither her lute, that she might again hear there the tones, to which Saint Aubert and her mother had so often delighted to listen. She went alone, and at that still hour of the evening which is so soothing to fancy and to grief. The last time she had been here she was in company with Monsieur and Madame Saint Aubert, a few days preceding that, on which the latter was seized with a fatal illness. Now, when Emily again entered the woods that surrounded the building, they awakened so forcibly the memory of former times, that her resolution yielded for a moment to excessive grief. She stopped, leaned for support against a tree, and wept for some minutes, before she had recovered herself sufficiently to proceed. The little path that led to the building was overgrown with grass, and the flowers which Saint Aubert had scattered carelessly along the border were almost choked with weeds, the tall thistle, the foxglove, and the nettle. She often paused to look on the desolate spot, now so silent and forsaken, and when, with a trembling hand, she opened the door of the fishing house, "Ah," said she, "everything, everything remains as when I left it last,
left it with those who never must return. She went to a window that overhung the rivulet, and, leaning over it, with her eyes fixed on the current, was soon lost in melancholy reverie. The lute she had brought lay forgotten beside her, the mournful sighing of the breeze, as it waved the high pines above, and its softer whispers among the osiers, that boat upon the banks below, was a kind of music more in unison with her feelings. It did not vibrate on the chords of unhappy memory, but was soothing to the heart as the voice of pity. She continued to muse, unconscious of the gloom of evening, and that the sun's last light trembled on the heights above, and would probably have remained so much longer, if a sudden footstep, without the building, had not alarmed her attention, and first made her recollect that she was unprotected. In the next moment, a door opened, and a stranger appeared, who stopped on perceiving Emily, and then began to apologize for his intrusion. But Emily, at the sound of his voice, lost her fear in a stronger emotion. Its tones were familiar to her ear, and, though she could not readily distinguish through the dusk the features of the person who spoke, she felt a remembrance too strong to be distrusted. He repeated his apology, and Emily then said something in reply, when the stranger, eagerly advancing, exclaimed, "Good God! Can it be? Surely I am not mistaken, Mlle. St. Aubert? Is it not?" "It is indeed," said Emily, who was confirmed in her first conjecture, for she now distinguished the countenance of Valancourt, lighted up with still more than its usual animation. A thousand painful recollections crowded to her mind, and the effort, which she made to support herself, only served to increase her agitation. Valancourt, meanwhile, having inquired anxiously after her health, and expressed his hopes that M. St. Aubert had found benefit from traveling, learned from the flood of tears, which she could no longer repress, the fatal truth. He led her to a seat, and sat down by her, while Emily continued to weep, and Valancourt to hold the hand, which she was unconscious he had taken, till it was wet with the tears, which grief for St. Aubert and sympathy for herself had called forth. "I feel," said he at length, "I feel how insufficient all attempt at consolation must be on this subject. I can only mourn with you, for I cannot doubt the source of your tears. Would to God I were mistaken." Emily could still answer only by tears, till she rose, and begged they might leave the melancholy spot, when Valancourt, though he saw her feebleness, could not offer to detain her, but took her arm within his, and led her from the fishing house. They walked silently through the woods, Valancourt anxious to know, yet fearing to ask any particulars concerning St. Aubert, and Emily too much distressed to converse. After some time, however, she acquired fortitude enough to speak of her father, and to give a brief account of the manner of his death, during which recital Valancourt's countenance betrayed strong emotion, and, when he heard that St. Aubert had died on the road, and that Emily had been left among strangers, he pressed her hand between his, and involuntarily exclaimed, "Why was I not there?" But in the next moment recollected himself, for he immediately returned to the mention of her father, till, perceiving that her spirits were exhausted, he gradually changed the subject, and spoke of himself. Emily thus learned that, after they had parted, he had wandered, for some time, along the shores of the Mediterranean, and had then returned through Languedoc into Gascony, which was his native province, and where he usually resided. When he had concluded his little narrative, he sunk into a silence, which Emily was not disposed to interrupt, and it continued, till they reached the gate of the chateau, when he stopped, as if he had known this to be the limit of his walk. Here, saying, that it was his intention to return to Estuvière on the following day, he asked her if she would permit him to take leave of her in the morning, and Emily, perceiving that she could not